All right, I'm big on starting on time. I'm Bill O'Hanlon. I think it's early in the morning. People will probably be wandering in. Just as an orientation to what we're up to here, I also want to remind you to turn your cell phones to the silent mode, stun mode, whatever you do, or turn them off so they won't disturb you or the people around you or me. So I'd appreciate that. Thank you. The second thing I want to orient you towards is that I'm Bill O'Hanlon. This is a presentation. It's a three-hour presentation, 8:30 to 11:30. We'll take a break in the middle of the doing, the viewing, the context, the common elements in all brief therapy. I also want to welcome our virtual and webcast and later through the recording folks and welcome here. And hopefully you'll get a rich experience of seeing it on video or on webcast, on live webcast. So thank you for being here. And to tell all of you that you can get a copy of these slides, minus the material I don't own the copyright for. You can get the slides if you just go to my website, BillO'Hanlon.com, click free stuff, and then there'll be a bunch of other options that'll show up, and one of the options will be slides. Give me a few days, and they'll be up there for about a month after this conference. So for those of you who are listening to a later DVD, they may not be available for you. I'm sorry. They'll be available till about, I'll probably keep them up there till February 1st of 2013. So you may be listening to this in another decade, another year, from your presentation, but not so early. I barely started. All right, so we've got a lot of stuff to cover, so let us just begin. And let me orient you to what I mean by the doing, the viewing, and the context. I want to tell you a story. Oops. We're not getting sound out of the computer, so let me just... All right, so let's go back. We'll play again.
Mr. Neureither has a problem.
Hauptproblem war, dass viele Leute das Haus verlassen.
It's a problem most nursing homes face.
Demente Menschen das Haus verlassen.
Which is...
Hello.
Demenz.
Dementia. Oh, Alzheimer.
They'll become disoriented and confused and suddenly think,
where am I? And
where am I?
This is not my world and I have to go back to my house. My children are waiting for me. And
usually, you know, nurses will intercept them.
Relax, you are living here.
But occasionally, people somehow slip out the front door.
Yeah, escapes, they happen.
And then they wander. They had one woman make it onto a bus.
And she escaped about how many kilometers?
She eventually made it to a town about 20 miles away.
Yeah.
They've had people turn up at grocery stores, wandering in the forest. They've even had people make it all the way back to their old houses and find new people living there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And for the people who work at the home, says Regine,
You get crazy not knowing where is a person and where did she go.
Test, test, test. Test. This is something we all know about.
You guys know I'm working on this story about the Alzheimer's.
Yes.
And while reporting this piece, I was checking in with my parents about some stories like this that happened to my grandpa.
Well.
And they told me one I'd never heard.
One morning.
This was in February.
Yes, this was on a very, very,
very cold,
frigid, cold morning.
My grandpa got up.
5 a.m.
Yes.
Left the house and walked to the train station.
He probably got the earliest tea.
Took it all the way out to Cambridge because he thought he had to teach a class at Harvard.
Did he used to teach at Harvard?
No, but he'd given lectures there.
So, anyway.
It's pitch dark early in the morning, frigid Boston weather.
And he was only in his long underwear with his coat and hat and scarf on over that.
He didn't even have shoes on. He was just wearing his slippers.
He was picked up by the police because he was, you know...
hypothermic.
He was hypothermic.
I mean, when they brought him into the hospital,
his temperature was
too low. Down.
I did not know that.
It was the moment when I knew that, that everything was going to have to change.
that he would have to move into a place that had a floor for people who were suffering.
A locked floor. That's what it meant.
So that essentially is the problem.
Some people have to be locked in.
Which just feels cruel.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Yeah.
It is.
And then in walks a fellow named Mr. Goebel.
No. Goebel sounds really awful.
Oh, really? Uh-oh. Okay.
Try to make it more like Goebel.
Goebel.
Yeah, bravo.
Okay, Mr. Goebel.
No.
No?
Goebel.
Goebel.
No.
Okay, we'll just use you saying it. You're Mr.
Mr. Goebel.
Okay, so
Mr. Goebel
was an older gentleman. He sat on an advisory board of the senior center.
And one day he came up with this idea.
Ja, wir haben
that's Richard Neureither again.
Das mit der Reimer besprochen.
And it's one of these ideas that's so out there and yet so simple that you think it just couldn't possibly work.
When Mr. Goebel came into the office of Richard and presented his idea, Richard was just laughing.
Aber es kam auch die erste Nacht zu Gesetz.
He thought it very funny. What a funny idea.
Well, what is it already? What's the idea?
Well, Mr. Goebel thought that right in front of the home, they should build a bus stop.
A bus stop.
What? Build a bus I don't understand. What would that do?
Well, think about what a bus stop is.
When you see a bus stop, it's the first step into the wide world. From a little bus stop, you get
anywhere.
Yeah.
Regine says that in a lot of these wandering cases, the first place people often head is to a bus stop.
Ah.
And so back to our friend Mr.
Goebel.
He thought what they should do is build a bus stop right in front of the home that has just one crucially odd feature.
There's no bus coming.
No bus?
Never. It's a bus stop to nowhere.
So his thought was it would be a way of catching people who happened to wander. They'd see the bus stop, go and sit on it, waiting for a bus that would never come. And then eventually a staff member could see them and bring them back.
Yeah, chief of the.
So while Richard's first thought was, this is ridiculous.
Second thought was, maybe not that bad.
So they bolted in a bench.
Made of iron.
Put up a sign.
In yellow and green.
Just like every government-issued bus stop.
And when you get out of the home, you see it immediately.
And the staff?
Also am Anfang gab's unterschiedliche
Stimmen. Say Richard and Regine just thought this was a stupid idea.
It's not appropriate or it's even cynical.
And most of all, that it probably just wouldn't work.
Yeah.
And at first, it looked like they were right.
Ja, wir haben viel gelacht, einfach so üblicherweise.
One by one.
The neighbors, you know, normal people, they said, oh, new bus stop. And they waited there for the bus.
Oh, no. And so, one by one, Richard would have to run out and explain.
Oh, that's not for you.
Was für ein Sinn dahinter steckt, ist meinem eher peinlich.
So there was this period of adjustment.
Yeah.
And then one day,
an old lady,
an actual patient from the home, started having an episode.
She was very troubled.
In her mind, she was a little girl, and she needed to get home to her parents.
My mother waits for me. I have to go home, very quick. The nurses talked to her and tried to calm her down, but she began to cry.
So they thought, well, let's just let her walk out.
It was fall, it was rather cold, so she went to the bus stop in her coat, in her hat, and she sat there very patient. And she waited for the bus. In the fresh air, sun shining.
And eventually a nurse came over and sat with her.
And they waited together, side by side.
And eventually, she forgot why she was there.
The nurse said, we go in and have a cup of tea together. And then she came back and everything was fine. She was relaxed. She was in the present time, not longer in the past time.
It's been 2 years since the bench first went up, and Richard and Regine say they use it all the time.
Every couple of days.
Sometimes the nurses will take someone who's upset and wants to go home.
The nurses say, let's go to the bus stop, let's see what we will do and how we plan the day.
Or
sometimes the nurses, they don't see that somebody escapes, and they say, oh, where is Mrs. Smith? And then they look out of, oh, she's waiting for the bus,
yeah.
And then somebody goes there.
But one thing is always the same. When the people get to the bus stop, the mood is very dark.
I'm feeling so lonely. I want to go home.
And also urgent.
My parents wait for me. My children wait for me. I have to go there quick, quick, quick.
But then, after a while, as they're sitting there thinking their escape is on the way, that urgent feeling
disappears.
Do you know why, or can, I guess, can you describe it disappearing? Like, does it go away slowly or suddenly?
Wie vergessen die dann so Sachen? Geht das dann so oder so?
Man muss unterscheiden, welches Stadium der Demenz die Menschen haben. Es geht ja nicht bei allen gleich. Wissen Menschen,
Richard says, it's like another thought comes up and then you forget what you wanted.
Yeah.
You know, it's like fishes coming up to the surface of the water and then going down again and disappearing.
So what's the problem? The problem is they forget that they're in a nursing home, that they're an elderly person, that they have dementia or Alzheimer's. They put in the, they sometimes will wander out and die. They'll freeze in the cold. They put in the bus stop. They go out there. They're all agitated and upset and have to go. They sit down and wait for the bus, and then they forget why they're there. A small intervention can make a big difference in people's lives, sometimes save their lives. So let me give you another brief illustration. This fellow here, you may recognize or you may not recognize, he's the guy, Roger Bannister, who ran the first four-minute mile. At the time when the four-minute mile was close to being run, there was a problem. Physicians had held forth and said it's physiologically impossible for a human being to run faster than a four-minute mile. It just can't be done. This is in the days before steroids. And Roger Bannister is one of those people who was really close. There were a couple of people in the U.S., another Brit, somebody in Australia. So there are about five people all over the world who were closing in, but they just couldn't break the four-minute mile barrier. And they'd been competing against each other and against that record for years. And Roger Bannister finally realized it was a mental barrier. It wasn't just a physical barrier. So he started to think, how can I think differently about this? I know, because everybody knows, you can't run a four-minute mile. It's just known in the world. So I can't think like that. I have to think differently. So what he decided to do was he decided to start to think, maybe I can't run a four-minute mile, but each time I go out, I can run 1/16th of a second faster every time I compete. And that's all I'm going to focus on. I know I can run 1/16th of a second faster. So every time he went out, his goal was to just run 1/16th of a second faster. Within three or four meets, he'd broken the four-minute mile. He wasn't focused on that clock and the four-minute mile. He was focused on running just 1/16th of a second faster. Once he broke the four-minute mile, he became the most famous person. We can't remember the name of the other four who did in the next year. Once he broke it, they could break it. Why? They changed the mindset. And now everyone knew it was physiologically possible for a human to run faster than a four-minute mile. Now high school students routinely run faster than four-minute miles. Maybe our training methods are better. Maybe they're on steroids, who knows. But they're running the four-minute mile now after all these years. It's 50 or 60 years since then. But why I tell you those two examples, the nursing home bus stop example and the four-minute mile example, the case I'm going to make today is that small or dramatic changes in three realms, and we'll talk about these three realms, the doing, the viewing, and the context, can move people forward and or solve problems. All right? And I've written about this a bit, and one of the notions I have is that there are successful change work, therapy, coaching, whatever, you know, leadership, anything like that, stands on two legs. One leg is joining people where they are, acknowledging them, just, you know, being sympathetic to them, really being in there with them. And the other leg is inviting them to new possibilities. And if you don't do both, your change work probably won't sustain. It won't work. And so sometimes you need to lean a little more on the joining people where they are. And sometimes you need to lean a little more on the change side of things, the opening new possibilities, inviting them, challenging them to move along. But I think both of those elements are really important. So I think there are four realms of intervention in change work, and then three realms of change. So that may seem confusing, but once I explain it, I think it'll be a little easier. So the four realms are the being parts of life, the doing, the viewing, and the context. All right? So what do you do about the being? I've written about this in several of my books, and this is maybe where the slides are a little off here. Do One Thing Different, the Change Your Life book. I've written about it in terms of trauma, in Quick Steps to Resolving Trauma, as a method, first joining people where they are and then inviting them out in these three realms. So the first realm is the being. And I think psychoanalysis and Carl Rogers, many psychotherapies have this idea that in order to help people change, what we need to do is just first accept them. If they get a sense we're judging them, they get a sense we don't validate them, or we haven't listened to them really well, or we're not really there for them, they'll get defensive, they'll push back, they won't join with you in the change process. So the first step is to give people messages they don't need to be any different, that who they are is okay. So that's our first test. Don't try to change the being. So this isn't a realm of change. This is a realm of acceptance, validation, acknowledgement, joining, whatever you want to call it, matching. So you don't want to change it. You want to value, validate, accept, acknowledge the person with all their sensations, all their experiences, all their feelings, all that internal stuff. We're not going to try and fix that. There's nothing to fix there. Right, or change. We're going to give them unconditional positive regard in the analytic setting, creating that safe place, that container, where they can just be as they are without judgment, without trying to be fixed, changed, anything like that. So most of us know this. This is part of our training as therapists, is just to create this welcoming, supportive, kind, unconditional love kind of atmosphere. Hopefully, I learned that from Carl Rogers. He was the first guy that really influenced me about that because he spoke about that so much, that if you really are there with people in that way, sometimes they'll spontaneously change. But even if they don't, at least it's the basis for the change later. All right? So I just want to get that bit out of the way. You don't need to, you know, sometimes what I say to my clients is, you're fine, and sometimes what you do or how you're thinking about it sucks. So you get the distinction? I'm just saying you're okay, but the way you're doing it is not so great. It's not working very well for you or the world or other people. So, you know, I'll just give you a quick story. I've done couples therapy a lot. I was trained as a marriage and family therapist. And one time I have this couple come in, and it's the typical situation that I saw a lot in my practice, and that is the guy has like twist marks on his arm when he comes in. He is not really excited about being there, but his wife has threatened to divorce him unless he shows up in counseling. So he's motivated because he doesn't want to lose her and he doesn't want to lose the marriage. Turns out that he's this very quirky, challenging entrepreneur, and he's made a lot of money in business by his quirky style. And his employees are always, you know, he's like pulling the rug out from under him. He screams at him at one moment. He's hugging him the next moment and crying with him. You know, he's just this really volatile guy. And he's this charismatic leader. And that works okay in his business, but it's not working so well in his marriage. So his wife is tired of this stuff, you know, all this manipulation, anger, all this kind of stuff that he just, you know, throws into the marriage on a regular basis, and misbehaviors of various kinds. So she's on the verge of leaving, but she thinks maybe there's a possibility of changing. So he comes in, and he lets me know in the first couple of minutes what he thinks of therapy and therapist types. He thinks they're sort of new agey, flaky people who aren't grounded in the real world like a real business person. And he's only here because, you know, he's afraid he's going to lose his wife, but he doesn't have any problems. She's upset, and if she weren't upset, the marriage would be fine. So it's a little bit of a challenge. But, you know, I'm kind of a quirky guy, too, with my own quirky sense of humor. And within about a half an hour, I got him. He really likes me. He's like, you're not bad for a therapist kind of thing. You know, I've won him over. So the second session comes, they come back, and this time I'm really focusing in with the wife on some of the stuff that he's done that's been really quite upsetting for her and destructive in her view for the marriage. So I'm talking to her, and she's listing some of the things he's done, which have been pretty outrageous. And I'm just listening to her and talking to her and trying to get a sense of it. And because he said before he didn't have any complaints, the marriage was fine as far as he was concerned, I wasn't really focusing so much on him. I was really trying to understand what she was upset about. And about 20 minutes into this, he just explodes from his chair and says, I'm sick of this stuff. He used a more colorful word. He said, you two are sitting here analyzing me and what's wrong with me. And he said, I just have to tell you right now, this is who I am. This is the way I am. I can't change. And if what you're going to do is going to try and change me, I might as well leave right now. The marriage is over. I can't change. And I turned to him. I was a little surprised because, you know, he must have been just sitting there kind of very quiet. And I said, well, I think you've misunderstood what I'm doing here and what we're about up here, in here. I don't want to change you. I said, you know, you're fine the way you are. She married you this way. And I don't want to change anything about who you are. But there's a few things that you do and a few things that you say that really don't work. And if that were true in your business, you were doing something that was losing you a lot of money, that was about to make you go bankrupt, I bet you'd change on a dime. He said, damn right I would. You can't do the same thing and stay in business because, you know, your competitors are always moving, the context is always changing, the environment's always changing, the economic environment. You got to turn on a dime and do something different. I said, that's all I'm asking you to do. Do something different, say something different. Who you are, we're not going to touch. He's like, okay, carry on. End of the story. He never got upset again about therapy because I had explained to him I wasn't trying to change him. If people think you're trying to change him, sometimes they get really upset and defensive and will block every attempt you make. So I wanted to make that distinction. You're fine. What you do sucks and is, you know, destroying your marriage. He got that. That was all right, as long as we made that distinction. So I want to, in this process, give people permission to feel what they feel, to not feel what they don't feel, to think the things they think, not think the things they don't think, to be as they are and not be as they aren't. So I call that two kinds of permission. Permission to and permission not to have to. You don't have to be smart. You don't have to be good. It's okay to feel ashamed. It's okay to feel scared. It's okay to be angry. Those are all the inside stuff. And I want to give as much permission as I can for whatever's going on inside this person initially, right? And also, even if they have opposite feelings, they love and they hate their spouse. They're calm and frightened at the same moment. They remember and forget. They forgive and they don't forgive. I just want to give permission for as much internal experience as I can. That's the first minutes of therapy or change work to me. If I don't do that, they're probably not going to follow me to the next thing, which is the three realms of change. So once we've established this relationship, which is a valuing relationship, and they know I'm with them, the next thing I want to do is invite them into change. Now, that takes from 3 seconds to 30 sessions, depending on the person, right? And depending on the situation, depending on your skill of joining with people, of really communicating that in nonverbal and verbal ways. And then the three realms of change are what I mentioned before. And we're going to talk about the doing, the viewing, the context. But what I'm doing with those, as I demonstrated, if those of you who are here for the demonstration that I did yesterday, was first making the smallest kind of change I can make in the problem pattern. Why? Because small change is way easier to make than big change. If you tell the person, get a divorce, quit your job, you know, be totally different from how you were in the relationship before or in your life, it's hard. That's really hard to make big changes. Little changes, way easier to make. So I'm looking to, once they get the valuing, acceptance, acknowledgement bit, I'm looking to invite them to make small changes in the doing, the viewing, and the context. We'll get into the details of that. I also want to change the sequence of things. Years ago, I used to live in Arizona, and I studied with Milton Erickson, and I studied family systems theory and techniques. I was into family therapy. And I went walking in the mountains after I'd studied with Erickson for a couple of years, and I was obsessed with his work. I read everything that he ever wrote, you know, 10 times. I was just reading it over and over again because he was so alien to the way I was being taught as a therapist. Erickson had a totally different approach. And I went to study with Erickson because I thought he was kind of a family therapist. And when I studied with him, he only saw individuals. So I was like, you know, I thought he was doing systemic work because I read Jay Haley's Uncommon Therapy. It was all about his family therapy work. When I went out there, he was only seeing individuals and mostly doing hypnosis. I was like, where's the system stuff? And what I finally realized is that Erickson had a different kind of systemic point of view. I'm walking with a friend in the mountains, and all of a sudden I have one of those moments of clarity. You ever get one of those moments where you just get a really profound insight? It's simple but really profound. And I'm saying to my friend who's not a therapist, I said, you know, it's really easy about therapy and change. All you have to do is figure out what the repeating patterns are that occur in people's lives. And one thing cues off another thing, cues off another thing, cues off another thing, cues off another thing, cues off another thing. And then it starts to be like a railroad, you know, car, a railroad, you know, a train that just goes around and around in a circle. It never gets off that circle. The person, you know, binges and vomits. Then they feel really guilty and really bad. And then they eat to comfort themselves. And then they overeat. And then they binge and vomit again. And they're, you know, and on it goes. And they get caught in this cycle of repeating patterns. And I said, all Erickson was doing was just finding any place in that pattern that he could make a change, that he could intervene within one of these little circles that I put up here, and between and how they hook together. He was just trying to muck up the pattern in the system. And so, you know, you can start anywhere on this. I thought, you know, I was up in the mountains with her, and I thought, you know, it's like 20 miles down, and I probably will forget this profound insight by the time I get down there. But I actually remembered it, and I had a little napkin in the car, and I quickly drew this on the napkin, and I remembered to this day, partly because of that, because I wrote it down. And so you can start anywhere on this model. Let's say you'd start with external environment. Something happens out in the world, and for it to affect you, you have to perceive it. And already there's a pattern. We learned that from, you know, NLP people. They're saying some people are much more oriented to taking in the world with their eyes. Some people are really auditory. They take in the world with their ears more. You know, if you're an infant you take in the world through your mouth. You're chewing on it. You know, you pick up everything and chew on it. You know, if you're orally oriented. Or, you know, there's people that they spend their whole careers perfumiers. You know, they smell things. They're really connoisseurs of smell. They're mostly oriented to taking the world in through smell. Or if you lose your sight, you know, and you're like a Stevie Wonder, Ray Charles, your hearing gets more acute. So you're mostly oriented to the hearing parts of life. So you're already biased once you pay attention to the world. What do you pay attention to, and how do you pay attention to it? So I once saw Virginia Satir working with a couple, and they're arguing, and they're down on each other, and they're really mad at each other. And she just says, I like you both to just sit here with each other, but this time close your eyes and really listen to one another. Don't open your eyes, because of course when they're opening their eyes, they're seeing the person's facial expression, which looks really angry and judgmental, and they're finger pointing. And once they close their eyes and focus on the hearing part, the discussion they had was totally different. One time I saw her, and I used to see Virginia's chair occasionally, she had them turn back to back and talk to one another, so that the input was different, if you will, from the world. All right? So you can either change how it's coming in or how it connects to the next thing. So you can change neurology. I think a lot of these EMDR tapping kind of things probably change neurology. If you're giving people medications like psychiatrists and neurologists often do and physicians do, you can change the neurology of people. If you change the meanings, that's cognitive therapists often change meanings, schema therapists, Jeff Young and those folks, you know, they're changing the meanings, reframing that, you know, strategic therapists or NLP therapists do. They do reframing or deframing. We'll talk about that. If you change the internal experience, you know, Eugene Genlin's focusing method, where you just have people focus, or mindfulness, where you just change your relationship with your internal experience. If you change your behavior, again, that's cognitive behavioral therapy or assertiveness training, or anything where you get people to do something different, or the kind of therapy that I did when I did couples therapy and family therapy, I'd get people to do things differently or speak differently within the session. So you can change any of these realms, and you either change the sequence, how they hook together, or you change any element of the sequence. And you could map almost all therapies onto this map, because some really focus on the cognitive or the meaning piece. Some really focus on the behavior piece. Some people focus on the body behavior. Some people focus on more overt actions. Some people focus on external environment, milieu therapy. You put people into a different environment, and maybe they'll change. You put them in group therapy, and maybe something gets different. You put them in a different environment, and things change. So that's one way to think about what I'm going to be talking about. So another way to think about it, and this is the whole solution-focused, resource-oriented, solution-oriented approach, is you find what worked before in terms of the viewing and the doing and the context. Search for previous actions that have worked. Search for previous directions of attention that have worked. Search for previous ideas or points of view that have worked. Search for context of competence, and then find ways to substitute those for some of those problem patterns within that sequence or the patterns that we're talking about that are associated with a concern, right? So let's take these one at a time and go into some more detail with them. Change the doing is the easiest one, because people can, no matter what they feel, you know, like if you're scared, you can still act against that, what fear is telling you to do. You can go out and do something that doesn't reflect fear. So doing is fairly easy to change for most people. Again, if you do small changes in doing, it's a lot easier. All right, and what do I mean by where to change the doing? Actions is the easiest one. Get people to do something different. Interactions. Get them to interact differently with somebody. Or again, if you're doing in-session changes, you can bring the couple or the family in, notice what repeating patterns happen right in your session, and make a change in it. So that's systemic therapy, couples therapy, family therapy, group therapy again, and how they speak about it. Again, some of you are here from my demonstration yesterday, and this woman was saying, you know, the world isn't fair, the world isn't fair. And I said, well, you know, how about it's fair except when it's not? And by the end of the conversation she had, she said, that's my philosophy. It's fair except when it's not. And I don't want to accept that the world isn't fair. And these people are trying to force me to accept that. And that's not it for me. And we just changed how she spoke about it and how she thought about it, which we'll get into the viewing. But it was a pretty simple change, but it was profound for her. That idea that the world is fair or the world's not fair, she had it as an either or, and I said the world's fair except when it's not. A very small change in the languaging of it, if you will. That's what Umberto Maturana called it, languaging. You language reality. That's kind of a jargony word, so I just said speaking. How you speak about it. Very simply. All right? So what are the methods for doing this? Give some homework tests. Tell people to go out and try something. You know, for years, in the first maybe 100 years of therapy was about sitting in an office getting insight. And then behavior therapy came along. Then, you know, assertiveness training, action-oriented therapy, psychodrama, things like that. We started to get people to do things. And one of the things, one of the places we got them to do things is go out in the world and try something different. So that's a simple one. Body shifts. Again, when I first became a therapist, gestalt therapy was really big. Fritz Perls would say, are you aware your foot is tapping like this or moving like that? The person would, you know, immediately stop, typically stop tapping their foot and change their body posture, and then something would start to shift. Or again, Virginia Satir, she used to do body sculpting. She'd say, now, I want you to act out the position you feel like with your husband. And the person would go like this, and she said, okay, great. And now she'd get somebody to stand up and look over the person and be pointing like this, and the person would be down, and she said, now, I want you to switch positions. Now, I want you to do that to him. And they'd feel a different feeling. And they'd have new options, new possibilities. So you could change body behavior right there in the room, or you could tell them to go out and change their body behavior. I was on Oprah with one of my books, and they cast about for people to try some of the methods in my book, which were change the doing, change the viewing, change the context. And they found somebody, and she told the greatest story. She said, oh, I've already done this. And they said, well, how'd you do it? And she said, I grew up, for some reason, with really low self-esteem. My parents weren't bad people, but I don't know. I just didn't like myself and didn't feel good about myself. And so I would go into every situation like I was wallpaper. I just never show up, and I would kind of hunch over my shoulders, and I would just try and disappear from any situation that I was in. And she said, that's just how my life went, and I was pretty miserable. And then Princess Diana came on the scene. And I saw her first press conference, and if you go back and watch this videotape, you'll see Princess Diana was like this, and she was very shy. She was kind of hiding under her hair, and she was trying to disappear. And here's Prince Charles just sitting there because he's pretty used to the press. This is very new for her. She's just like shrunk down. She said, I saw that interview, and I was riveted. That's me, she said. I'm just like Princess Diana. You can tell she's trying to disappear, and she's really low self-esteem. It turns out later through her biography, we found out she was. And she said, then I watched her over the years, and she just started to grow. And by the end of her life, she would stand up straight and tall and meet people and look them in the eye, speak confidently, and she thought, if she could do that, I can do that. So I just started to walk like this instead of walk like this. And she said, I just stood up straight. And I looked people in the eye. And she said, it was the weirdest thing. My whole life changed. Men were running to open doors for me. They'd never even noticed me before. People at work were saying, did you get a makeover? She looked differently. She spoke differently. She just changed her body behavior very, very, very simply. And I was so touched by that story. It was such a small change, but it made such a big difference. Couple and family interactions, as I said, change the language, externalize. There's Jeff Zag tells a story about a woman he's working with, and she's really depressed, and he keeps working with her, and they can't really make the depression move. And finally one day, you know, inspired by Erickson, who did weird things like this, he tells her, I want you to get the biggest rock you can fit into your purse, and I want you to spray paint it black. Wait for it to dry, put it in your purse, and carry it around with you for a week. It's a pretty heavy rock, and she's carrying this thing around. Obviously, it symbolizes her depression that's dragging her down. And at the end of that week, I want you to go and find a place to leave that rock so you don't have to carry it around anymore. And the woman goes to her father's grave and leaves the rock. And the depression starts to lift. That's externalizing. You've taken it and you put it out in the world. I had a client that was cutting herself. And she lived a long way away from where I lived. 6.5 hours, actually. And I'd been to her town, done a workshop. And she had called me and said, you know, can I come see you? I can only come once a month. And we made a 3-hour session. Fine. Okay, so she comes along. We start working on that. I said, you know, you live a long way away. I don't even know the resources there, the hospitals, or the psychiatrists in your area. And so you have to make an agreement that you won't cut yourself when you come to see me. We're going to do this work. We're going to try and get you through it. But I got to have your agreement you won't hurt yourself. She's like, oh, I don't know if I can make that agreement. You know, she'd been doing it for a long time. And her typical thing was she would start to feel this pressure build within her. She'd get really upset. She'd cut herself. She'd dissociate while she was cutting herself. She didn't feel it. And then she would be taken to the emergency room. The emergency room people would give her a lecture. You can't do this, because she'd shown up there a number of times. You've got to stop doing this. And she would just be dissociated. It really didn't touch her. And they would sew her up, and she'd just be gone. And that was relief for her, because she was in such emotional pain usually. To dissociate like that was really a relief. So it didn't bother her. It bothered people around her husband and other people, you know, the emergency personnel, things like that. So it was kind of a solution for her, but it obviously didn't ultimately sort out the problem. It just got her away from her pain for a while. So I said, okay, you can't do that anymore. You got to agree if you're going to come into treatment with me, you can't do that while you're in treatment with me. So she agrees, reluctantly, but she agrees. So she comes along, we're doing the work, and you know, we're working for a few months, and it's actually going very well. But one time, about 2 weeks before her next appointment, she calls me on the phone and says, you know, I know we have an agreement that I'm not going to cut myself, but I am telling you it's all I can do to keep myself from cutting myself. The pressure is building so strongly as we're getting into this work. And she said, I'm not sure I can keep that agreement anymore. And I said, well, we still got an agreement. It's 2 weeks till the next appointment. So can you keep it for at least those 2 weeks? She said, yeah, I think I can, but it's just barely. So we got to come up with something to help me with this. Okay, right. She comes in. I have no clue. You know, she comes in, and it's 2 weeks. And in the ensuing time, I went out to a shopping mall one day, and I was walking through the shopping mall, and they had some temporary booths set up. It was near Christmas. And I just walked by, and out of the corner of my eye, I happened to catch one thing that was on for sale on one of the booths. And it was a raggedy antique. It was a little antique show, and it was a little antique Raggedy Ann doll that was 43 years old. She was 43 years of age. So it was, you know, that really grabbed me. I was like, she's 43. This doll is 43. And it was just this Raggedy Ann doll. And I never had a Raggedy Ann or Raggedy Andy doll when I was a child, but I'd never seen one. But this doll was really quite striking, because she was a very loving person, and all it had was a heart on it that said, I love you, which I guess all Raggedy Ann dolls have, but I didn't know that. And so I buy this doll, and when she comes in, she, as you might imagine, she had been abused when she was younger, sexually abused. A lot of people cut themselves, have been traumatized in some way. And so she comes in for the next session, and I say, I have it in my briefcase, and I say, hey, you know, we were talking about you cutting yourself. I think I have something that will help. So she said, what? And I said, I bought this for you, and I picked out the doll, and she looked away, and she said, the doll doesn't have any clothes on. I said, yeah, and you're a good seamstress, so I want you to make some clothes for this doll. But really what this doll is for is, this doll is you. And if you feel the urge to cut yourself and don't think you can stop yourself from cutting yourself, what I'd like you to do is cut the doll instead. So she agreed. We put the doll in a bag. She took it home. She felt the pressure building more and more to cut, and one day she got the doll out, and she, this is a little gross, but if you have trauma, just dissociate while you're listening to it, it's not you. She cut the hands off, and she, in a rage, she cut the hands off, she cut the feet off, she gutted the doll, and she slit the throat of the doll. Then she sewed it up, and while she was sewing it up, she just sobbed deeply, deeply, deeply. She couldn't stop crying. It was such deep crying. And remember before, when she'd go to the emergency room, she'd be dissociated. But she couldn't dissociate as easily about the doll. She felt such grief that the doll had suffered so much. Obviously, for her, you can imagine, because the doll was her. And she sewed up all, she sewed the hands and the feet back on. She sewed up all the wounds. And then she made kind of coverings for the doll, little pieces of material that went around where she made all the slits. And then she made an outfit for the doll, and it was this elastic neck and long dress that went all the way past the wrist so you couldn't see the wounds, and all the way down to the past the feet so you couldn't see where all the cuts had been. It was a covering for the doll. And then, interestingly, never cut herself again, never had the urge to cut herself again. That was seemed to be sufficient. And she, that doll became a comfort for her, and she would leave it in the nightstand. Her husband didn't approve of therapy. He thought he was a very frugal guy, and he thought it was a waste of money. And so, but she knew it was necessary, so she was paying for it out of pocket. And she had an inheritance she was using, and he disapproved of that. And but so he thought she was kind of indulging herself, basically. So she would, when she'd get frightened in the middle of the night, she'd just reach into the nightstand without disturbing him, pick it up and just hold this doll to her chest and just feel comforted. And then before she fell back to sleep, she just slip it back into her nightstand. And when therapy was over, we, you know, resolved things, she brought the doll to me and said, "Here, this is your doll." And I said, "No, no, I bought that doll for you." And she said, "No, this is your doll." And I said, "No, I think it's your doll." And she said, "Trust me, Bill, it's your doll." And so I trusted her, and I took the doll back, and I'm sure some of you know what this all means, but it's way too deep for me. But interestingly, and this is something I learned from Erickson, just a little postscript to the story. Erickson once had this woman that he worked with, and he also used externalization. She was having psychotic experiences, and she kept getting fired from her job because she would stay home for 3 days because she was residing in her crystal palace at the bottom of the ocean. For some reason, that wasn't a good work excuse, and they would fire her from her job. She was really good at her job. She was an executive assistant. She was a high-level one for, like, presidents of major corporations, but she would get fired from the job because every couple of years, she would have a psychotic break, and she would stay at home, living at the bottom of the ocean, and she would come back. She was very open. She said, "Oh, I was down and living in my castle, crystal castle, at the bottom of the ocean for 3 days," and they'd look at her and say, "We didn't vet this person very well," and they would fire her. And, you know, because you miss work, but also they'd get a little worried about her at that point. Otherwise, she was pretty normally functioning. So she came to see Erickson because she was tired of getting fired from job. And Erickson taught her hypnosis and taught her to go to the crystal cave at the bottom of the ocean in 15 minutes. She could do time distortion. So everything went well until she got recruited by a big corporation in a different city, and she had to leave Phoenix, which is where she was in treatment with Erickson. And she said, "What am I going to do if, you know, this breaks through and I can't do my time distortion thing?" He said, "What you do is, if you have a psychotic experience, when it starts to happen, get a manila envelope, open it, put the psychotic experience into the manila envelope, seal it, and send it to me." Erickson was a weird fellow, and she clearly bought this, and she routinely, every couple of years, a manila envelope addressed with her return address would arrive at his office. He would take it, file it in the filing cabinet. That's what impressed me. He kept them. About 12 years later, she revisited Phoenix. She showed up at his office and demanded to see all her psychotic experiences. He He pulled them out of the filing cabinet. He gave them all to her. She opened them one at a time, ascertained that her psychotic experience was still safe in his mental illness in his office, gave them back to him and left. I was so impressed that he kept those for 12 years, that I kept that doll, and 10 years later, about, that woman called me up with the doll and said, "Do you still have that doll?" And I said, "Yeah, it's right here in my office, in my closet. I can see it right from where I'm sitting on the phone." She said, "Good. That's all I wanted to know." Boom. End of the story. And again, I'm sure some of you know what that means, and it's very deep, but I had no idea, but I was glad I had the doll. I still have it. So another one that's classic thing is reverse the direction of your action or your striving. Again, Erickson tells a great story about this. Early in his life, he was lived on a farm, and his father was trying to pull a stubborn calf into the barn, and the calf just dug in its hooves and would not go. And his father's pulling it, and this calf is stronger than his dad, and he can't do it. And Erickson watches for a little while, and he says, "Wait a minute, Dad." He goes behind the calf and pulls its tail, and the calf runs into the barn. Calf just wanted to be resistant, right? So he just gave it something to resist, and by resisting, it ran the other way. So we do that sometimes with problems. You know, stop trying to keep yourself from having panic attacks. Go have the best panic attack you can have. And as you might imagine, that collapses at least one level of fear. If you've seen Reed Wilson here, he does something akin to this, is having people go into the fear rather than avoiding it. So that's another change the doing. You change the direction of your activity, of whatever it is that you're trying to do. I'm sure you can think of some examples of that. So that's the stubborn mule example. Try and change the doing of it. Instead of trying to fix it, you try and make it worse. Classic paradoxical intention that Viktor Frankl talked about. He discovered, I don't know if you ever heard this story, but Frankl discovered paradoxical intention, if you know about that method, he was living in Austria, and there was a story that showed up in the Austrian newspapers of a kid who is a stutterer, high school kid. And his high school decided to put on a play, and the play had a stutter in the play. Made sense. The directors went, the students who were directing it went and said, "Hey, part's perfect for you. You want to play the stutter." And he had always harbored a secret ambition to be on stage, but of course thought because of his stutter he never could, so this is his big chance to be in a play. So he agrees. But he goes and memorizes all his lines, but when he gets to dress rehearsal, he can't stutter. He speaks perfectly clearly. No stutter. As he tries to stutter, the stutter goes away. So the story gets to the newspaper. Frankl reads it. He has about 3 or 4 stutterers in his practice. And he thinks, "Why don't I try this?" So he tells him, "I want you to deliberately go out and stutter worse. Exaggerate the stutter." And with a few of them, the stutter goes away. And it's the solution. And then he starts to use it with insomnia and impotence and a few other anxiety and phobias and things like that. So it's another way to shift the doing, to just change the doing. All right? So where to change the doing? You can change it right in your office. You can have people do things right in your office that are different to change the doing, or right in your treatment center, or you can have them do it between sessions. And both of those work. You just have to experiment around to find out what's the most effective, right? So here's some examples. Again, Erickson had such colorful examples and poetic examples, but he worked in psychiatric hospitals, which were called asylums, when he worked at them before they had psychiatric drugs. So he had to come up with creative ways because, you've seen all the classic movies about that. They would often just warehouse the mentally ill. They wouldn't do much with them because there wasn't much to do. They'd give them sometimes cold baths to try and shock them out of it. Then they came up with electroshock therapy, and that was pretty, and lobotomies and things like that. These were pretty terrible methods. Erickson, very pragmatic Midwestern guy, he decided he'd experiment to find out what worked. So he gets a job at a new psychiatric hospital, new asylum, and he's going to be the chief psychiatrist, and he comes there, and there's this patient nobody's been able to do anything with because he won't say anything to anybody. He was hospitalized because all he would do is cry hysterically and just do this. He was pushing things away from him. So Erickson reads his case history, and before he was hospitalized, he was a successful businessman who went bankrupt. And ever since then, all he can do is cry and push things away. So Erickson observes him for a couple of days. Then one day he walks by, bless you, he walks by and says, "You know, you look like a guy who's had his ups and downs in life." He grabs the guy's hands as he's doing this, and he just starts to move him like this. Guy's okay. He just keeps crying and moves his hands like this now. The other psychiatrists and staff think, what was the use of that? But it's only the first step. Erickson comes back the next day, grabs the hands, and he puts them a little closer together, moves them up and down. Now the guy does this, very stylized movement. He's crying. He's doing this. Next day, he brings his hands a little closer together. Small changes in the doing. Get this, right? Next day, he brings him down to the voc rehab part of the hospital, where they get people involved in crafts projects and art projects and things like that. And he sets him up with an upside-down table that has paint peeling from it, and he straps a piece of a sandpaper on each hand. And he starts to move the guy's hands right near the table, but not right on the table. And pretty soon, just from random movements, the guy, every once in a while, the sandpaper hits the leg of the chair, of the table, and starts to peel off some of the paint. And pretty soon, the guy's gone like this. And pretty soon, he's gone like this. And he's sanding the table leg. Pretty soon, he gets really involved, and he sands the whole table, all the old paint off it. He stains it. He turns it into a really beautiful table, and everyone admires the work. And very soon, he's carving chess sets to sell to the other patients and to sell to the staff. He's making some money. He makes enough money. He stops crying. He makes enough money, gets out of the hospital, makes $10,000, and this is in the 1950s, the first year he's out of the hospital. What? Did Erickson get deep insight into his problems and help him understand that? He just changed the doing. Changed the context too, but we'll get to that. All right? That's a pretty dramatic example. Here's another one. Yeah. Yeah, the guy started talking, interacting normally. He had to sell his chess sets. Yeah. Yeah, so he started talking, interacting normally, stopped crying. Stopped crying within a couple of days of getting deeply absorbed in doing this table thing. So, yeah. Just, you know, meaningful activity. But there's a lot in that thing, but it's a typical dramatic Erickson example. So that's why I use it, because most of us will do this in very simple, everyday ways. But Erickson had such dramatic examples, they make the point in a very highlighted way. But, yeah, you start talking normally, interacting normally, not just crying all the time. Here's another one. Erickson's doing family therapy. He has a whole family in his office, and every time he asks somebody a question, mother answers. He'll say, "Son, what do you think about this?" Mother says, "Well, what he feels about that, you know," she starts to answer. And everyone just shuts up because mom talks all the time. So Erickson says, after about four go-rounds of this, he says, "Madam, do you have a lipstick tube in your purse?" She said, "Oh, yes." He said, "What I'd like you to do is get that lipstick tube out of your purse, and I want you to open it and, you know, draw it out. Put it right so it's just barely touching your lips. And notice how when I ask one of your family members a question, your lips want to move." Isn't that an interesting thing? So she's got a new task. She has to notice when her lips want to move. She stops interrupting. Now, that's also changing the viewing, and we'll get into that in a minute, but that's changing the doing, right? I told this example yesterday, so again, some of you are here. Jeff Zweig saw one of Erickson's former patients. Erickson retired from practice in the mid-70s, late 70s, and Jeff had by then moved to Phoenix from where he lived out here, and he took over any of Erickson's old patients, or the ones he hadn't finished with, or the ones who would come back. One time, somebody comes back who's seen Erickson about 20 years before, and Jeff Zweig, who's always really interested in what Erickson's doing, says to the guy, "What did you come to see Erickson for 20 years ago?" And he said, "I came to see him for two problems, smoking and a social anxiety. When I was around people, I was so anxious, I just could barely stand it." And he said, "You know, so did he help you with either of those problems?" He said, "Well, he helped me with one of them. I'm totally over the social anxiety. I got over it fairly quickly." He said, "But I still smoke after 20 years, and that's why I've come to you, because I need help stopping smoke." He said, "Just curious, how did he help you resolve the social phobia?" And he said, "What he told me was, when I walked in a room full of people, like a party or something, I just repeated in my head, 'Don't give a damn, don't give a damn, don't give a damn, don't give a damn, don't give a damn.'" Jeff was stunned. He said, "That worked?" He said, "Yeah, it worked like a charm. Never had social anxiety after that. Had to do it a few times, and that was it." Weird, huh? Very weird. A change in the doing. You just change what you're saying to yourself. Don't give a damn, don't give a damn. And it was a nice ambiguous phrase. I thought, does it mean I don't give a damn, or I shouldn't give a damn? I don't know. You know, it's weird. I like that example. I'll give you one from my experience when I was on Oprah, and I the book was Doing Think Different. Yeah. I don't know. Well, you'd have to ask Jeff. I don't know what he did. You know, clearly whatever Erickson did 20 years before hadn't worked, but I don't know what Jeff did. I think Jeff helped him, but I'm not sure. You'd have to ask Jeff. I never heard that part of the story. I know. I hate to sell a story when you don't know the full ending, but sorry about that. So when I was on Oprah with this book, Do One Thing Different, you know, got out pretty big because Oprah has a big footprint, and this woman wrote me a few months after I was on the show and said, "I really loved seeing that show on Do One Thing Different, and I really liked your approach, and I went out and bought your book after I saw the show." She said, "I have a need, and I wonder if you could help me with it. I need a referral in my area," and she lived in a very large metropolitan area, I won't say which one, "and I need a person who can help me with an addiction using your approach, because I already tried 12-step approach. The addictions, the typical addiction stuff doesn't work for me. I've tried it a number of times. It's just not working. So I saw your approach and I thought it would work for me, but I need somebody to help me implement it. Do you know anybody who works your way in my area?" And so I did. I knew three addictions counselors in her area that worked using a solution-oriented method. So I gave her the referrals. Didn't think anything more of it. About a year later, she wrote me and said, "I don't know if you remember me, but I wrote you about a year ago and asked you for people in this area that did addiction stuff and told you I had a pain pill addiction. And oh, yeah, I remember." And she said, "I just wanted to let you know what happened." She said, "I didn't really tell you a lot of details at the time," but she writes me her story. And her story was this. She had been a heroin addict when she was a young adult. She lived on the streets in this large city, and she lived a pretty sordid life. She did very terrible things to get her heroin, and she lived homeless. And one day, she heard a street corner preacher preaching about Jesus. She stopped and listened. Every day, she'd go back. After a few days, she really got enthralled with this street corner preacher. He was quite compelling, really good, and she went through a conversion experience, got Jesus, stopped using heroin, changed her life. Well, this street corner preacher was so charismatic, he attracted a number of followers and some donations, and he started a church in that area. And she went to work for the church. She had been the church secretary for 20 years, or 25 or something. I mean, a long time. And every once in a while during a service, they would trot her up front as a testimonial for what Jesus can do for you, because she was this sordid heroin addict who now has this great life, and Jesus had made all the difference. So she would come up and give a testimony. And about 2 years before, she'd had some growing back pain, and she finally decided in consultation with her doctor to get back surgery. And when she went in, she said, you know, like, if you're going to give me some post-operative pills, you got to know I was a heroin addict and I can't have anything that's addictive. They said, don't worry, what we give you is not addictive. And they gave her OxyContin, and it was just a little addictive, and she became heavily dependent on OxyContin. She started going out on the street and buying OxyContin, and she, you know, she was a church secretary. She didn't make that much money, but she saved her money over the years, and she, you know, invested. She owned a house, you know, which wasn't paid off, but she paid it regularly. And all of a sudden, she wasn't making her payments. She was maxing out her credit cards. She was borrowing money from Peter to pay Paul, and she was going out and buying 27 pills. She was taking 27 pills a day. She was really, really heavily dependent. And it was getting worse and worse. And so when she wrote me and I gave her those names, she said, I called up those people and I told them my circumstances, and they all offered to give me a discount because of my dire financial circumstance. But even at a discount, and it's a big city, the best they could do is like $70 an hour. She said, I had no money. I had maxed out my, I had taken out a second mortgage. I had maxed out my credit cards. I had no money. So I realized I couldn't even go to therapy. I just couldn't afford it. You know, because I really wanted your approach. So she said, finally, I just decided I can't go to therapy. I'll just reread the book and see if I can put the methods into place of this do one thing different idea. So she reread the book and she came up with an idea that every day she would take the 27th pill and she'd shave a little off it. She wouldn't really notice. It's just a little. Then the next day she'd shave a little more off the 27th pill. Bless you. The next day she'd shave a little more. And gradually she got down to 26 pills. And then she'd start to do that with the 26th pill. And she got rid of the 26th pill. Took her a while. It took her 8 months to get rid of all the pills. She did it a little at a time by changing one small thing. She said, I've been sober for 4 months now. Your book saved my life. I thought, okay, that was worth writing that book. You know, that's pretty good. Somebody you met, never met, you changed their life, perhaps saved their life, by this very simple method, right? It's one small thing that's different, changed the doing. Now, again, some of you work in a much different way of working. You think, how could that possibly be therapy? They didn't get any insight into why they were an addict. They didn't work through their emotional issues. Yeah, sorry. It just worked. Right? Let me give you another example. This is Andrew Solomon. Some of you know Andrew Solomon. He's written a book called The Noonday Demon. It was an atlas of depression. He traveled around the world to find every culture's way of thinking about depression and treating it, because he suffered from a serious depression himself, and he recovered from it, and he wanted to know, how do people think about depression all around the world, and who's doing anything effective? And one time he heard this story about a woman in Cambodia that was dealing with women who were extremely depressed post-traumatically after the Pol Pot killing fields. Most of you know that stuff. And here's the story about changing the doing.
You mentioned that you went to different cultures, different countries, to understand depression there. You went to Cambodia. This is after the killing fields, after Pol Pot had practically performed genocide on his own people. The amazing thing there is that not everybody is depressed, that some people kind of carry on without depression. What are some of the things that your experiences looking at depression in Cambodia made you realize about depression?
Well, one is that I realized that people are incredibly resilient. I mean, I discovered as I looked around at the world that there are some people who are in poverty-stricken countries, who have had entire families die in famine, who have been through the most unbelievable, horrendous circumstances, and who nonetheless absolutely cling to life, who you see sort of doing whatever they can, eating whatever comes to hand just in order to stay alive. And I thought, look at all of the people who commit suicide in the most supportive and prosperous and comfortable societies on earth. There is a difference between the people who are subject to depression and the people who seem not to be subject to depression. But in Cambodia in particular, I had a really amazing experience with a woman who treats depressed people in Cambodia and who described how she worked with survivors of the Khmer Rouge who were severely depressed, and she said she tried to work with them in three stages. She said they all were people whose minds were so crowded with horror that they could barely get up and function. She said there were women who had been through these terrible traumas of the Khmer Rouge period and couldn't take care of their own children because they were simply disabled to the point at which they didn't feed the infants who were sitting next to them. She said, and I tried to teach them three things. She said, first, I tried to teach them to forget. And I did that by asking them to remember what had happened, to talk to me about it, and then to talk about other things so that I could begin to fill up their mind with some other things that would take up some of the space that was taken up with their terrible memories. And then after they had begun to forget, I tried to teach them to work. Sometimes all they would be able to do was to clean up their own houses and maybe to gather firewood in the jungle, she said, whatever it was, but I would teach them to do something so they had something they could start and do and say, this was my thing and I did it today. She said, and then, because I was working with groups of women, mostly in resettlement camps, she said, I taught them to perform manicures and pedicures. And I said, you taught them what? She said, the women of Cambodia who had been through these experiences had been in a country in which half the country turned against the other half of the country. And I taught them to do this because it was a system in which they touched each other's hands and feet in a way that was at once intimate and non-threatening. And in doing that, they began to talk to each other, and they were enjoying the idea that they were being made somehow more beautiful while they did it. She said, and it taught them to begin to open up to other people and to trust again. And when they had learned to forget and to work and to trust, then I tried to teach them that those three activities were not separate, but were part of a single sensibility. And when they had learned that, they were ready to go into the world again. And as I listened to what she was saying, I had a sense that here was a culture that was really quite foreign and quite different from American culture, and a society that had been through enormous traumas, but that the basic building blocks of reconstructing personalities that had been ripped apart by going through such enormous trauma were really quite similar to the ones that people go through using very sophisticated Western techniques of psychotherapy.
I know depression is commonly thought to be a broken brain disease and a biochemical deficiency, but these people are recovering from depression by giving each other manicures. How could that possibly be? Well, what I'd suggest, if you have that hypothesis that it's a broken brain and that's a biochemical disease, that touching other people's hands changes your brain. It changes your biochemistry. That connection with other people changes your biochemistry. So I hope I'm making my case here that what here's I don't know if you remember my basic premise. My basic premise is that all change that happens, no matter whether you do psychodynamic therapy, psychodrama, gestalt therapy, transactional analysis, cognitive therapy, behavioral therapy, ACT therapy, mindfulness therapy, Ericksonian hypnosis, it does not matter what therapy you're doing. Ultimately, the only way it has an impact is if it changes the doing, it changes the viewing, or changes the context. That's how people change. So why not bypass all that rigmarole and go directly towards changing the doing, changing the viewing, changing the context? But here's the key, of course. Not everything you do that changes the doing, the viewing, and the context changes. So you have to do a bunch of experiments. What's going to work for this person? What makes sense to them? What are they willing to do? What actually shifts them? They could do a lot of things different. It might not make any difference at all. But this woman found a method with the people who'd suffered so from trauma in Cambodia, watching their families die, sometimes being made to kill their family members or choose between family members, children, like Sophie's Choice kind of thing. And these women are healing from traumatic, post-traumatic depression by working, changing the doing, right? By speaking about the trauma and then speaking about something else so they can fill their minds with something else in the horror and giving each other pedicures and manicures. It all fits into this category for me of what I started to realize, because it was so different from my early training as a psychotherapist when I went to see Erickson. All Erickson was doing, for me, it was changing the doing, changing the viewing, changing the context, either by mucking about with the patterns of it, what you were doing now and getting you to do something different, or evoking something else that could be put in its place, a resource, another way to think about it, do it, or be in a different context. Sometimes Erickson would send people out to do things in the world, and we'll tell you some examples of that. So that's changing the context. But this was a really powerful example to me of the power of these small and simple changes. All right? So before we get into change the viewing, I've taught this a few times before. And I know in the you're a little bit of a skewed sample because you're at a brief therapy conference, but I know in the context of general therapeutic ideas, this may be a little hard to swallow. So, what are your comments or questions on that? And there's a mic there, and there's a mic there. And if you go to one of those mics and ask one of these questions or make a comment or a concern that you have, I'd be happy to speak to it. And if there's none, I'm happy to move on, and because I can dominate the conversation very easily, I have quite a bit to say. What was that? Yeah, soon, at 10 o'clock, yeah. Thank you. Washroom break soon. That was the suggestion. That's doing one thing different, huh? Yeah, a question and what it means, a comment about how you think about this, or a concern, like, yeah, what about this? Go ahead. Our AV person disappeared again, it appears. So, is that one working? Yeah, is there an on-off? And if there isn't, why don't you say the question, I'll repeat, or the comment, and I'll repeat it. Say it loud. So, when people, yeah, a good question or a good comment. When people have come to see us, what's my idea about why they haven't changed it themselves, the doing or the viewing or the context themselves? Sometimes they have, and then they don't come to see us. But sometimes they just get stuck in a loop, and they don't know how to get out of it. Or the way they think about... Can someone stand up and just tap the microphone while he's back? Oh, thanks.
Yeah, what number, Mike, do you have over there?
What's the number? Just tap it for a second. Yeah, that's it. Okay, good, great. So often it's the viewing. They have an idea what the problem is and how to solve it, and the way that they're going about solving it is not helpful. But they still have that idea. Like, I'll just tell you an example, and then this is sort of foreshadowing the next thing we're going to go into. Years ago, when I was first a family therapist, I read this article by some family therapists, and they said, when the family brings in the kid and they... You know, they put the kid forward as, this kid has a problem. They usually frame it in one of a couple of ways, a few ways. One is, this kid is bad. He's misbehaving. He's really bad. Or, this kid is sad. He's really depressed. You know, he's upset. There's something going on inside and we can't get to, and he's acting strangely or having troubles because of that. Or, he's crazy. That's mad, if you want to think about it. So they said, it's bad, sad, or mad. And all they would do, their only technique as family therapists was, when someone come in, the family come in and they say, this kid's bad, they'd say, oh no, I think he's really sad. They would just reframe it. Give him a different story. And they would, you know, after interviewing the family, and they would come up with enough evidence, this kid is really sad, he's depressed. Or he's post-traumatic, or he's anxious, or whatever. You know, they just talk about his internal upset. And then, you know, if the parents came in and said he's sad, they say, no, he's actually bad. He's misbehaving, and you really have to, you know, structure his environment. They would just change it from one story to another, and often the problem would resolve. Because the parents were trying to, if he's bad, they try and solve it in one way with punishment and, you know, exhortation and consequences and things like that. If he's sad, they're going to have an entirely different response to it. So it changed the doing, it changed the interactions, it changed the viewing, it changed the context. So I guess that's my best explanation. But to tell you the truth, the question you ask is a really good question, because
I'm almost entirely uninterested in it. That is, when I do therapy, I'm much more interested in the intervention than the explanation for why they have a problem. And I started to divide therapy into two categories. I mean, it's a little all or nothing, but I went to the first Evolution of Psychotherapy conference that some of you have been to, you know, this big Woodstock of psychotherapy where you see the most famous psychotherapists you've read about before they die. And so, you know, it's Albert Ellis, it's Carl Rogers, it's Virginia Satir, it's Chloe Madonis, Viktor Frankl, you know, it's all these people that you read about in your training, you know, they're famous people, and you go see them. Everyone I went to, what happened for me is I'd be nodding in their presentation. Yeah, that's it. Well, Carl Rogers, yes. It's just unconditional positive regard for people, listening so deeply, and this deep respect you have for people. That's it. And then I go to Jay Haley and say, no, everything's a triangle, and you have to strategize, and you have to change the interactions in the family. There's always three people in the room, even when there's not three people in the room. And I'm like, yes, that's right. That is absolutely right. Then I go to Masson, and he said, you know, really, it's early parenting, and there's Swiss cheese in people's personalities, and they use other people to try and fill in the holes in their Swiss cheese. And I'm like, that's my clients. Yes, that's right. And then they get on a panel and they would just disagree radically with one another. And then I realized that's all story. In the end, what do? How do they intervene? And you might say, well, they need theory to drive that. I, after a while, just started to become, you know, like there's like know-it-all people. I became a not-know-it-all therapist. Like, I have no idea why problems develop. But I have a lot of ideas about how to intervene in them. And I find that a lot better way of working. That is, my clients are going to have theories, and I'll go with their theories. Why did that develop? You know, my mother was domineering. Oh, yeah, sounds like it. You know, that probably led to this situation you're in. Now what can we do? I'm really interested in the what can we do now. But it's a good question. I mean, it's a philosophical question for me, but it's not a practical question for therapy because all I'm trying to do is this. That's it. I've just gotten simpler as a therapist because before I'd be studying all these theories, trying to find the right one. I don't think there is a right one. There's just a bunch of explanations, some of which are more helpful for a particular person in a particular situation, but there's, you know, I once saw a T-shirt at an amusement park, and I wish I'd gotten it. It said, I've given up my search for truth, and I'm now looking for a good fantasy. And I thought, that's it in psychotherapy theory for me. I've given up my search for truth, but I'm looking for a useful fantasy to move us forward. Did you want to go back up to the mic when you were there before? Or no? Okay. If you go to the mic, that'd be great. They've got it working now, so we could all hear. Thanks. I won't have to translate. I appreciate that.
Traditionally, I've always, the answer I would give to why people don't change their own behavior is that they get payoffs in doing what they do.
It's a nice idea.
And where I've spent...
It's not true, but it's a nice idea.
Okay.
No, I mean, you know, that, and I don't mean to make fun of you for having that idea. We all have those ideas, and that's a common one. It's a really good one. Either it has a function or there's a payoff, and that's either true or it's not for this particular person in the situation, but I'd be wary of that as a general explanation.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so I appreciate you going up, and I'm sorry, you know, I didn't mean to, you know, humiliate you or make fun of you. I make fun of all the theories because they're all in the same realm. They're made up. But when you have it, it's not made up. It's the truth. Other people's, you can see how theirs are made up, but it's really hard fish in water to see how yours are made up. That is absolutely a hypothesis. It's useful for some clients. It's not useful for other situations. And when it's working for you, use it. And what I'm suggesting, what the limits are, if you get a client and you're doing that payoff thing and it's not yielding the therapeutic results, drop it like a hot potato and consider another story, another explanation. Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
So would you say that you aren't 100% committed to the interventions that you're suggesting, but you're trying them out? And
that's right.
Then
that's exactly right. Yeah. I am not 100% committed to those interventions because I don't know if they're the right ones.
So, okay, so how do you get your clients to go along with them if you're presenting them as a possibility, but not...
I say this is an experiment. We'll find out whether it works. And the only way, you know, if you're a scientist and you propose an experiment and they say, and I already know what the results are, why bother doing the experiment? Then you're not a scientist. You're just making up a theory. But I want you to be a scientist in your life, I'll say. I'm not sure this will work, but it might. And I really, we give an explanation for why it might often. And then go out and try and come back and tell me what worked and what didn't work. I want the results of the data, not your conclusion.
Do you think Erickson presented it that way, or do you think he did it with certainty?
I think he did it with certainty. Yeah, Erickson was a very certain fellow. And I do it in a different way. I do it like Lincoln did it, if you saw the movie. I tell stories, I use humor, and I engage interpersonally, and hopefully I'll have some influence on them. Yeah. Okay. So, thanks. Yeah.
I really like what you're saying.
Thank you.
The only concern I have is you have studied this form of therapy and that form of therapy.
I agree.
And read the books, everything he read 10 times. The problem is for younger people coming in and hearing what you say, they need some guidance, something in their head, more than one thing in their head probably. I believe many things in their head, like you have in your head. So they have things in their pocket. And they're not just trying anything.
Yeah, well, that's why I'm giving you this model, because that's something to have in your head. This model isn't true either.
That's right. It's one wonderful model.
One way to think about it. That's it. And I agree with you. All I do is go in, hopefully, I'm sure you do this too. We learn so many things, and then Carl Jung said, learn your theories, learn your methods, then go into the session and forget all that and marvel at the unique human being that's in front of you. But there's nothing to forget if you don't have anything in your head.
Exactly.
You never learn anything, but people learn things all through life, as well as in psychotherapy theories. I take your point. I think it's good to have lots of stuff in your head. I read widely outside of psychotherapy. I watch movies. I observe people in airports. I get hypotheses and ideas all over the place. So I get a lot of ideas from movies. They're great. All right, so let's take a bathroom break about... Can you do it in 15 minutes? It's a couple minutes before 10, so if you come back at 10:12, we could start right at 10:15. Thanks. Okay, number 16, thank you. All right, so how time flies when you're having a break. Thanks for coming back. I had some interesting discussions over the break. All right, so this, to me, is a big one. Changing the doing, kind of obvious a little. Changing the viewing, I think, again, many therapies do this, and they do it in different ways. But changing the viewing, let's hear a story about this. This is Maya Angelou. Oh, this should be playing. Why is it not playing? Is that me or you? Let's go out of this and check my volume. No, I'm not getting any sound off my computer. I need sound on the computer. Still not getting any. There we go. All right, thank you. All right, here we go.
Once sent a relative that told you that when you look at your life and your life purpose, and there's things about yourself you don't like, change them.
My grandmother.
What you can, was it your grandmother?
My grandmother.
And you come to a certain point where you can't change the rest, you have to change the way you see it?
Mm-hmm. She said, sister, if you don't like anything, then do your best to change it. But if you can't change it, then change the way you think about it. What I've deduced that to mean is if I can't change it, I change my position of looking at it. And there, by seeing it from a different angle, I might be able to change it. Or I might find some good in it that I can use, which might make it change itself. But I'm not just going to continue to beat the head against an iron post. I might be able to find a way, if I don't just look at only the iron post, I might find, there's concrete at the bottom. This post is set in concrete. Now water can wear away concrete. You see, and so the way I look at it, the way I think about it, helps me to ultimately change it. That's how I deduce her from her lesson. It is said that one has so many teachable moments. My grandmother caught me at every one of mine. When complainers would come into the store, my grandmother would call me from wherever I was and say, "Sister, come here and stand behind the counter." She would say to the customer, "How do you feel this morning, Mr. Shepherd?" And the man would say, "Oh, Sister Henderson, I hate the winter. I just hate it. It's cracking my skin and I just can't get warm. My hands are so..." And my grandmother would say, "Mm-hmm." And then look at me with piercing eyes, like, "Did you hear that?" Or in the summer, the person would come in and Mama would ask, "How do you feel, Sister Williams?" "Oh, I hate the summer, Sister Henderson. I just hate it, you know. It just, when my scalp makes me itch and then my skin and..." And then when the person would leave, she would call me. She said, "Sister, there are people all over the world, white and black, rich and poor, who went to sleep when that person went to sleep. They will never wake again. Their beds have become their cooling boards. Their blankets have become their winding sheets. And they would give anything for just 5 minutes of what that person was complaining about." I tell you, my grandmother did that. She got to me.
That's changing the viewing. So Maya Angelou says she learned when she was growing up from her grandmother, which she also called her mother, who raised her mostly, says, if you can't change it, change the way you look at it. And it served her well throughout life. That's changing the viewing. Here's another example from Patch Adams. He's committed to a psychiatric hospital.
How many do you see?
This guy's also committed, an eccentric billionaire.
They're four fingers, aren't they?
No, no, no. Look at me. You're focusing on the problem. If you focus on the problem, you can't see the solution. Never focus on the problem. Look at me. How many do you see? Look beyond the fingers. How many do you see?
Eight.
Yes. Eight's a good answer. Yes. See what no one else sees. See what everyone else chooses not to see. Out of fear, conformity, and laziness. See the whole world anew each day. Now, the truth is, you're well on the way. You didn't see something here besides a crazy, bitter old man. You wouldn't have come in the first place.
So that's Patch Adams' origin story. He's depressed. He's suicidal. He has himself voluntarily committed. The treatment is a nightmare, terrible treatment in the psychiatric hospital. There's this one guy there that he walks around and he holds everybody's hand up and says, "How many?" He holds his hand up and says, "How many fingers do you see?" And they say, "Four." He says, "You're useless." And, you know, so they just think he's a crazy old guy because there's four fingers. And then he finally lets him in on the secret. And just after that, the guy's coffee cup is leaking and Patch Adams picks it up and he puts a Band-Aid on it and goes, "Okay, Patch." And that's how he got his nickname. So he patched the coffee cup. And he says, "See something new every day." And he decides to go into medicine because he's so pissed off about what happened in the psychiatric treatment, he decides to become a doctor and help people heal. He's always going to look for the different point of view, and he becomes a humorist, almost gets kicked out of medical school, but starts, some of you know the story. He changes the viewing about medicine and decides he wants to change medicine because he's so upset about how it's done in this grim way and humiliating to people. So he wants to lighten things up. So what to change about the viewing? There's several places to change viewing. One is, where are you focusing your attention? That's what that guy did. He said, no, you're focused on the problem. You'll never see the solution if you focus on the problem. Look beyond the problem. That's a shift in focus of attention, right? There's also a shift in perception. We'll talk about this and get more into it. And a shift in meanings and interpretations. That's why, Walter, when you stood up, I didn't mean to be so confirmed, but it's like, that's a meaning and interpretation. It's a fine one, but don't confuse your meanings and stories and interpretations with the truth. Because then you'll be stuck with only one point of view, and that's what happens with our clients and patients. They get a point of view, and our job, in part, is to shift their point of view. You were talking about working with kids in this screwed up school system, and the parents come in focused on the kid, focused on this kid being bad or dumb or wrong or whatever it may be, and you're saying, you know what? Your focus is in the wrong direction. Focus on the school system. That's where the screw-up's occurring. And they look somewhere else, and new possibilities start to appear. If they keep focusing on the kid and how bad he is, that meaning and that focus of attention, the same stuff's going to happen over and over again, typically. If you can shift the focus of attention and striving and, all the other stuff we're talking about, that's when things change. So meanings, interpretations, stories, schemas, theories, assessments, whatever you want to do. So, I don't know if you ever saw that movie Up. It's this animated movie where the guy and the kid that's a Boy Scout and everything, and they meet this talking dog. It's a long story. We won't get into it. The talking dog comes up, and he's like, hey, I want to be your best friend. He's, a typical dog. I love you. I want to be your best friend. And then they're talking to him, and they're asking him some really important questions. He said, well, you can only escape from this terrible trouble by squirrel. He's like, squirrel. He keeps being distracted by that. So what's the focus of attention? What's the perception? What's the meanings and interpretations? That's what you're going to change. I found this this thing on the internet I really like, that don't believe everything you think. Because what you think, the mind can be talked into anything, basically. And what happens for human beings is they start to believe what the mind tells them. This is the truth. This is the way it is. And so I like that saying, don't believe everything you think. There's a record playing. And I found this from Emile Chartier, the French philosopher. There's nothing as dangerous as an idea when it's the only one you have. Ideas are great. And when they work, terrific. When they don't, sometimes people just get stuck with them. They just keep thinking of it in the same way. And, again, I was talking to somebody who also had the privilege of spending some time with Milton Erickson. You couldn't sit with Milton Erickson and have the same idea you had when you came in. He was really good at pulling the rug out from under your ideas. You were talking about, this is a story of the man who forgot to stutter. That had never occurred to you, this idea that you could forget to stutter. You'd had lots of ideas about stuttering, but never that idea. And all of a sudden, there was a new idea that showed up, and of course, he made it compelling in some weird way, however he did that. We'll talk about that. But it's when you get the fixed idea about it. Again, when I started teaching about psychotherapy, this is what pissed me off. I was like, there is one theory that people have, and I call that delusions of certainty, and our theory sclerosis, It's like, we just get sort of stuck with this one way of thinking things, and that's akin to what happens with our clients. Why should we as therapists be so inflexible as our points of view as our clients? Because we need to have a little more flexibility than they do, I think. All right, so how do you change the viewing? The first one, and again, if you spent time with Erickson, this is what he specialized in, deframing or confusion. I walked in with a certain idea, sat down, and within a few minutes, that idea was, I wasn't so sure about it.
So, you know, confrontive therapists, you ever see Fritz Perls do his thing? Maurizio Andolfo, you know, they would immediately, Carl Whitaker. I once saw Carl Whitaker working with someone. And he's working with his family on the stage. 500 people out there. He sits down. He hears a few things about the family. And the father says something. And he turns, Whitaker turns to the father and says, I think you're lying. Guy, you know, has a reaction. They said, you know, and they get into an argument up here on the stage. And the guy's like, and Whitaker's just, he's so relaxed. He's just like, what are you so upset about? He goes, you called me a liar. He said, I did no such thing. He said, yes, you called me a liar. And Whitaker said, I never said you were a liar. And, you know, I'm sitting out there thinking, I think he said he was a liar. What's he on about, you know? And so they go through it, and they're going through it, and they're going back and forth, and Whitaker's unperturbed. And this guy's getting more and more upset, and he's looking to the crowd, and the crowd's kind of nodding. Didn't he call me a liar? And people are like, you know, he's getting support from out there. And finally Whitaker, you know, comes, he lets him get really agitated for a while, and he said, I didn't say you were a liar. I said I thought you were lying. I said I thought you were lying. He said, I have all sorts of crazy thoughts. What are you taking my thoughts seriously for? I don't take them seriously. And the guy, you know, gets it. And he realizes he's been taking on all of his family's ideas about him. And it's really a great, profound therapeutic shift. And I was like, I don't think I could have done that. Whitaker just argued with him for like 15 minutes to make a point, if you will. And he just started somewhere. You know, it had nothing to do with the kid and why they were there. He went somewhere else and deframed the whole thing. And now they were having a totally different discussion. So if you've ever seen provocative therapists, they do this. They know how to shake you up so you're out of your usual frame of reference. And they do it in confusing ways, provocative ways, or they just say, you know, I don't think that's true. I think the opposite is true. Or this is another story. Or that's not the story. You know, when I said to you, well, dude, that's not true. It's an interesting idea. That was deframing. It was challenging that idea. And then, of course, reframing is offering a new view. You do that with your families. You go, it's not the kid, it's the system. That's a reframing. It's a challenging the old view, but it's offering a new view. If you said, look, your kid isn't the problem, that's just deframing, if you could convince them of that. But you say, it's not your kid, it's the system. Since 2001, you have a good story about it. Since 2001, here's what's happened. No kid left behind. It jams the kids that don't fit into the usual pegs. And your kid has gotten caught in this. I'm going to help you get your kid out of this dilemma and empower you to help change the system and get your kid out of this problem. That's a new story. It's a new view. It's a good one. It works, except when it doesn't probably, but generally it works. And you're passionate about it, so you sell it well too. There's many ways to sell the new idea. Disrupt the current focus of attention and distract. So I'll give you a quick example. I'm going to give you a few examples, but I'll give you a quick example that comes to mind. And again, Erickson, he's so weird. He's so inspiring for me because he's so dramatic. You can kind of get the more everyday examples when you think of these dramatic examples. He has this guy who has an elevator phobia. Elderly gentleman, happily married, you know, just straight guy. And Erickson tries everything with him, can't get him over his elevator phobia. And this is the days when they have an elevator operator, which, you know, pulls the younger people have seen movies about this, but we've been in these elevators, older people. And, you know, they open them, they close them, and they press the button for you, right? So Erickson arranges for this guy to go into an elevator. This is the 1950s. Go into an elevator, has a female elevator operator. And Erickson's already arranged it with her before he's gotten in the elevator. This guy, he says, okay, we're just going to get in the elevator. We're not going to go up. I've arranged it with the elevator lady here. And so they get in. She closes the door. The guy starts to get really anxious. And then as soon as she closes the door, she turns to the guy and says, you're so handsome, I'd like to kiss you. And it's the 1950s. This guy's an elderly gentleman. He's very straight. And he says, madam, I'm married, you know. And she says, I know, but I just can't seem to resist. And then she presses the button for the top floor, and she starts to move towards me saying, madam, madam, madam. And pretty soon she opens the door, and they're on the top floor. And he looks around. They walk out with Erickson, and he's like, how did I get here? He forgot to have his elevator phobia. Why? His attention was elsewhere. Let's just say that. Right? That is a weird thing. So once he had one experience of it, he knew that he could have another experience. And that started to get treatment to move. So that's disrupting the current focus of attention and distracting people in some way. Right? I'll give you some more examples of this as we go along. Shift to a new focus of attention. Change your perceptions or memories. And I'll give you some examples of this. There's some pretty cool ones. Okay, so how do you do this? I was trained, again, kind of Carl Rogers approach. I learned you ask a question, you listen to the answer, you reflect, you move a little more. I started to work with Erickson, and he had a totally different approach. He would ask a question, you'd say a few things, he'd look at the floor, and he'd talk for 2 hours. He would tell stories. I mean, was that your experience? And I was like, this is how you do therapy? Aren't we supposed to chat a little? No. He would tell stories for, like, sometimes 45 minutes, sometimes 2 hours, sometimes 15 minutes, and then he'd look up and say something else to you. You'd say something else to him. All right. And then he'd do hypnosis or he'd tell stories. I was like, what? And so I started to tell stories. I never told a story as a therapist in my life before I met Erickson. I just thought, they're supposed to talk, not me. But after I watched the results that Erickson would get, I thought, I'm going to learn to tell stories. They're powerful ways to invite people to a new point of view and a new experience of their thing. And so for me, I use a lot of storytelling and a lot of analogy when I do it. Now, I'm somewhere between Erickson and, you know, Carl Rogers. I ask some questions. They say something. I tell a story. I ask them another question. They say something. I tell another story. I maybe do hypnosis, whatever. So, you know, hypnosis is another way that I learned to do it. It's a way to change perception in a very seamless way and a very smooth way to me. If I just told you, go change your perception or your focus of attention, you'd say, I'd like to, but I don't know how to. But in hypnosis, you can invite it in a really nice way, I think. Change perceptual modalities or submodalities. This is really weird because as I was putting this presentation together, I used to work in a mental health center, and I had a colleague who worked at the mental health center. And one day, this was maybe 35 years ago, he told me something that it was always this anomaly that he told me. I never really thought about it until recently when I was putting this together. He told me that when he worked with people who had traumatic memories that would haunt them, flashback kind of things, he would do this thing where he would have them imagine, go back to the memory, but change it in some significant way. That is, he'd have everybody in the traumatic scene, the person who was traumatized, imagine that they'd all taken a hit of helium and they were speaking like Mickey Mouse. And they had Mickey Mouse voices. And he told me this, and I'm like, what? He said, it works really well. I said, how could that work? I mean, that's the weirdest thing. And how do you get people to go along with it? He said, they really like it, you know? And he said, you know, like, I'll have them imagine everybody's blue like the Smurfs or something like that. And I'm like, what? And he just told me, like, these three or four examples, and I just said, this guy is weird, and, you know, he's very creative, but I can't even believe this works. And I never used it. I never even thought about using it. I just thought, it's that guy, and he does this weird thing, and he says it works, and maybe it works for him, but that doesn't make any sense to me. Now it makes perfect sense. How you know, we know about brain plasticity. How you encode things, and you keep thinking of them the same way, gets grooved, like a record gets grooved. And it turns out that if you can knock the person out of the groove, they can have new thoughts and new perceptions, and memory sometimes gets shifted. It doesn't haunt them in the same way. So I've had people look at the memory as if through the wrong end of a telescope, so it seems very far away. I've had them change the color, make it black and white, turn the volume down, turn the volume up so it's distorted. Frame, put a frame around the image, turn it to the side. Weird things like that. Once I remember what that guy did, and then I learned about NLP submodalities, I thought, all you got to do is play with all these potential sensory memory elements. The visual, the auditory, the kinesthetic,
the gustatorial factory sometimes are involved, but not always. So just start to mess around with them in one way or another. How they're getting input, as I said before, you know, how they're taking the information in, how they're representing it to themselves, and how they're expressing it. So I'll give you an example of the expression one. I had a couple that was about to divorce, and she would occasionally hit him, you know, would physically just strike him, sometimes with her fist, sometimes with her open hand. And he was, you know, they were right on the verge of divorce. They had a couple of kids. And when I spoke with them, I met with them as a couple, not with the kids, and they were telling me the situation. She said, you know, I get so frustrated with him because I get upset about something, and he tries to calm me down. And the more he tries to calm me down, the more upset I get. And he says, you know, the thing is, she gets so out of control and she starts swearing, and we have kids and we have values. We don't want to swear in front of the kids. And I try and calm her down, and the more I try and calm her down, the more outraged, and the more she swears, and she gets louder. And I grew up in a family with a lot of yelling, and I just close down when people yell. So the more I close down, the more she gets upset, and she says, yeah. Then he closes down, and I just have to have a reaction. He just starts to sit there like this, and I just have to have a reaction. Finally, I hit him just to get a reaction. I'm out of control, enraged. So this is the pattern they went through again and again. And she said, you know, I really need him to listen and give me a response. And he says, I can't when she gets that upset. So we're in a dilemma. So I say, okay, let's try this experiment. The next time you get upset, I say to her, you can tell you're starting to get really worked up, go into the other room, get out a tape recorder, and record what you want to say to him. You can yell it, you can say it, whatever you need to do. You can express it in any way you want, but just record it. All right. You go back out of the room and say, there's something for you to listen to. He goes in the other room, he can listen to it whatever volume he wants. If it's too loud, he can turn it down so he doesn't freak out. You're not there, so it's not in front of the kids. He won't try and calm you down. That's good. He has to listen, and then he can come back out and say his response to you. And if you start to get jacked up, both of you, you have to go back in. And if that doesn't work, he has to record his response. You have to go in the other room, listen to his response, and record your response to him. And it stopped, the whole thing. They never got into a physical altercation again, because we changed the mode of expression. We also externalize, but that's a different thing, right? So what we're trying to do is mess about with how people are viewing things or expressing things, if you want, and then notice the unnoticed. That's what you're doing with your families. You're saying, you're not noticing this. This happened in 2001. You're not noticing this is happening in the system, and you're putting it all on the kid. I want you to notice some things you didn't notice. You're waking them up to something. Mindfulness. What is that? You know, mindfulness is one of the big new interventions in psychotherapy. What are they having people do? Notice things they didn't notice. Right? Focusing did the same thing, that Eugene Gendlin technique, right? So, I like to tell stories, and one of my favorite stories, I have people that saw me in a workshop 30 years ago, and they'll come up to me at this conference and say, I haven't seen you in 30 years, but I went to one of your workshops in Philadelphia or something in 1982, and they say, I don't remember what the workshop was about, but I remember a story you told. It was about the Room of 1,000 Demons. Right? So, yeah, there you go. This is a story that I read when I was a teenager. I used to be really interested, you know, I grew up Catholic, but I sort of started to doubt my faith when I was a teenager, and I was exploring other philosophies and religions and spiritualities, and I read these books by this guy who was supposedly a lama, a Tibetan lama, who'd been reincarnated as a British dentist, and his name Tilab Seng Rampa, and because he'd been transplanted through a psychic operation, through a silver cord psychic operation, he still remembered all of his previous lives, so he could write all these books about him. And they were cheap, terrible novels, but each one had something really good in it. And I was exploring, you know, Tibetan Buddhism, which was exciting for me at the time. And I still remember a story they told that he told in one of the first books. He told this story about the Enlightenment ceremony that was called the Room of 1,000 Demons ceremony. And the Room of 1,000 Demons ceremony was a ceremony, you know, in Tibetan Buddhism, there's this idea of reincarnation. You just get reincarnated again and again because you have to burn off your karma and you have to learn things in each life. And pretty soon, when you get reincarnated enough and you learn enough, you don't have to get reborn anymore. You go off the karmic wheel, you get to nirvana, you don't have to be, you know, being reborn again and again. So they have this ceremony once every 100 years in ancient Tibet, in which all the lamas line up, and the Dalai Lama with the pointy hats and their golden maroon robes, and all the students in their white robes have been studying meditation and reading the sutras and all that stuff, are lined up. And the Dalai Lama says, this is a ceremony of the Room of 1,000 Demons, and usually to be enlightened, you have to study Buddhism and get reincarnated again and again and again and again. But in this ceremony, you can get enlightened today. This is like instant mic enlightenment, you know, instant microwave enlightenment. You can get enlightened today if you go through the ceremony and make it through. And it's called the Ceremony of the Room of 1,000 Demons. And why it's called that is you go into a room that's filled with 1,000 demons. When you walk into the room, you open the door. When you walk into the room, you go into the room, and the door closes behind you, and there's no doorknob. You actually have to walk all the way through the room to find the doorknob to get out. It's not locked or anything, but you have to get through the whole room. The room's about as big as this room. So here you are. You walk in, door closes behind you, and all of a sudden you're confronted with 1,000 demons who have the capability to take from your own mind and your own heart your worst fears and make them real. That is, seemingly make them real. It creates a scene in front of you that's an illusion, but it looks really real. If you have a fear of heights, what happens is you walk in your room with 1,000 demons and you're standing on the small ledge of a tall building, the window's blowing. The wind is blowing and you're afraid to take another step. If you're Indiana Jones, there are snakes in your room. The only thing Indy's afraid of, right? If you're afraid of spiders, it's what's in your room. If you're afraid of being abandoned by the person you love or people you love, that's what shows up in your room. So a lot of people, when they walk in the room, get paralyzed with fright, and they can't move forward. They don't move forward. And the rules are, we can't come in and get you. So some people die tortured by their worst fears in their own room with 1,000 demons. So if you want to go home, no hard feelings. About 90% of students disappear at that point. That seems too frightening. Because they could just die in that room, tortured by their absolute worst fears. 10% of them stay, and so the Dalai Lama says, okay, we've done this once every 100 years, and some people have made it out the other side. Some people do die in there, so it's a risk. But when the people have come out the other side, we've talked to them, and the tradition goes down is, how do you make it through? And there are two hints we have for you. The first one is, when you walk in the room with 1,000 demons, remember what they're showing you is an illusion. It's not real. It seems real, but remember, it's not real. But it seems as real as this reality, so it's hard to remember that one. So very few people were able to use that hint. But so that second hint might be more useful for you. The second hint we have for you is, when you walk in the room with 1,000 demons, no matter what you see, no matter what you hear, no matter what you feel, no matter what you think, keep your feet moving. Because if you keep your feet moving, you'll eventually get to the other side and get out of the room, and that's enlightenment. Where you're no longer fooled by the mind's stories and ideas, and you can actually move through life in a way that you're not so fearful. So I've had clients that I've told that story to. They'll come back another week, you know, after I've told them that story, and they'll say, oh man, I had the worst week. And then they get a big smile on their face. They said, but I kept my feet moving. It becomes a new frame for them to think about how to deal with their issues. And again, people remember for 20 or 30 years sometimes. They don't remember anything else I said, I guarantee, 20 or 30 years ago. But they remember that. That was the one, I'm a married man, madam, please take me to my floor. That was the elevator one. This was a weird one. Erickson had this guy who had a fear of traveling. He had a sort of agoraphobia. He could only go to the outer limits of Phoenix, and then he would get faint. He would develop panic attacks and get faint. So he couldn't travel. He couldn't leave the city. And he was kind of bound there, and he was really unhappy about that. There were reasons why he should travel and needed to travel, but he couldn't. So Erickson had him do this task. This is in the days Phoenix was kind of more rural. He had him get in his car, would dress up in his finest suit, his best suit. Erickson gave him a letter that Erickson wrote, Dr. Erickson wrote, saying, "I'm this man's psychiatrist. If you find this man passed out by the side of the road, please, you know, call me. I'm his physician, Dr. Milton Erickson," and he gave his cell phone number. And he had the guy pin this letter to the lapel of his favorite suit, his finest suit, and he had him drive to the outskirts of the city, and as soon as, of course, he would approach, the panic would start, and he would start to feel faint. So Erickson had, it was a rural area, so he just had him drive on this dirt road and floor it as fast as he could, and then when he'd start to feel faint, he could just, you know, his foot would go off the gas and he would drift to the side of the road and, you know, he would faint. And it would happen. He would faint. And he said, "Then I want you to get out and lie down in the ditch until you don't feel faint or nervous anymore. Get back in your car and drive to the next telephone pole. And if you're still feeling panicked or faint, get out, lie down in the ditch until you calm down. Get back in the car and drive to the next telephone pole." This guy did, he was supposed to do it at like 2 in the morning so there'd be nobody around. And the guy did it like 5 telephone poles and he said, "This is, you know, I'm getting my best suit all dirty. This is, I feel like a fool." You know, he just gets in the car, he floors it and drives up to Flagstaff, which is a couple hours drive away. He's just like, "This is ridiculous." And he breaks the thing. Now that is a totally weird thing to do, isn't it? It's changing the doing and changing the viewing. Gets him to focus on something else. My coat's getting dirty. He's going to focus on the next telephone pole. You know, that kind of stuff. Really weird thing, right? Here's one of my favorite ones, and it occurred in this city. Erickson used to travel around teaching seminars like this, hypnosis and psychotherapy, and he had a child and adolescent psychiatrist who lived here, was one of his students. And so Erickson was teaching at a seminar here, and this guy called him and said, "I have a really resistant adolescent patient that's getting in all sorts of trouble, and nobody can help him, and I haven't been able to help him. I like him a lot, though. I have a really good connection with him. I just can't get him to change. He's misbehaving, and he's getting in all sorts of legal trouble and all. Could you see him while you're here as part of your workshop?" He said, "Yeah, I'll use him as a demonstration subject." So this guy arrives with this kid who's been told about the great Milton Erickson, and this guy has a good relationship with the kid, and he says, "You know, this guy is my teacher, and he's the most amazing guy. Come on along." So he comes along. They wend their way up through this big room where there's a lot of professionals sitting there waiting to hear this great thing. Kid gets up there, sits on the chair. Erickson looks at him, you know, "Glad to meet you." He looks at him. He says, "I just have one question for you. How are you going to change your behavior?" They sit there for a minute, and Erickson says, "Thank you for coming." They walk all the way back there, and the psychiatrist is in the back, and he's thinking, "What the hell? I thought he was going to..." I guess he decided he wasn't a good demonstration subject, and he wasn't going to use him, because Erickson can kind of see things about people. Over the next month, the kid made radical changes. So how do you explain that? Before, everybody was focused on, you know, fixing this kid. And Erickson just said, "I don't know how you're going to change your behavior." Number one, the implication is he's going to change his behavior. Number two, Erickson didn't know. So who was supposed to know? This kid. He was going to have to figure out how he's going to change his behavior. And the implication was he was going to change it. There's nobody to resist anymore when that happens, right? So that's an example of changing the viewing. Again, a dramatic example, and most of us won't do it in that dramatic way. So let me play you an example of Jeff Zeig, who's organizing this conference, doing what Erickson called the confusion technique. He sometimes would have people that just have one fixed idea. Erickson would try and shift them, and they wouldn't shift, so he just overload their conscious minds. These were people who are very analytical, analyzing everything, and it just was getting in the way of them getting the experience of change. So Erickson came up with this technique, and it involves pairing opposites, concepts, enough so that the logical mind gets overloaded. So you'll hear Jeff do an example of this.
And the fact that sometimes a child opens up a wrong gift, a gift that wasn't exactly meant for him or her, and the child has to learn something in that regard, with an understanding that there's a history involved there, and that there's a series of mistakes that that child makes, and sometimes the child makes the right mistakes for the wrong reasons, and sometimes the child makes the wrong mistakes for the right reasons, and some of those mistakes that are right now can be wrong at a later time, and some of the wrong mistakes now can be made right at a later time, and some of the understandings now that can be misunderstood at a later time can only be understood at a far later time. And that whole series of events is given, relegated to the unconscious mind, where it becomes a storehouse of learnings, potentials that can be realized.
All right, so you get the idea. And he just go on and on. And Erickson once said, if you can't get someone into trance any other way, bore the hell out of them. But he would go on and overload the conscious mind, and you just couldn't process after a while. Somebody who really wants to understand everything, then they go into the state of open confusion, if you will. And then new possibilities of viewpoints and ways of doing things occur. Right?
I'm going to
play this. It'll go through Zeig very quickly. Let me give you an introduction. This is a so I study with Erickson, and I realize I got to learn to tell stories, and I am not a storyteller. But I love hearing stories, but now I've got to learn to tell them. So I read everything I could about storytelling, but I came across a resource that turned out to be one of the best resources. It's the National Storytelling Center in Tennessee. They have a yearly conference of the best storytellers in the country and later in the world. And I bought all their tapes, and I listened to them 1,000 times to learn how to tell a story orally. It's different from writing a story if you're a writer. It has expression to it and gesture if you're doing it live. And so I started to hear the best storytellers, and this is one of my favorite ones, and it's a change the viewing story, all right? So you'll listen to this. This is called Flowers and Freckle Cream.
When I was a kid, about 12 years old. I was already as tall as I am now. And I had a lot of freckles. Some of them have disappeared. But my mother would look at me and shake her head and say, "You can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear." Now, I had a cousin whose name was Jeanette Elizabeth. And Jeanette Elizabeth looked exactly like her name sounds. She had a waist so small that men could put their hands around it, and they did. She had waist-length, blonde, naturally curly hair. But the unforgivable sin was that she had a flawless, blemishless, peaches and cream complexion. I wanted a tree to fall on her so bad. I was just at an age where I had begun to really look at myself in the mirror, and I was underwhelmed. I decided that the thing that would make all the difference in the world was if I had beautiful skin. Beautiful skin meant all one color. And so in the back of Jeanette Elizabeth's True Confession magazine, I found an ad for freckle remover. I knew that I could send for it if I saved my money, and I did. I had been assured in the magazine article that it would arrive in a plain brown wrapper. Freckle-colored. I went to the mailbox every day for 3 weeks, precisely at the time that the mail was always delivered, because I knew if someone else in my family got the mail, I would never hear the end of it, because there was no way that they would let me open the box in private or let its contents remain secret. After 3 entire weeks of scheduling my whole day around when the mail truck would arrive, the package was delivered. I went to my room with this package, and I sat down on the edge of my bed, and I opened the box. I was sure that I was looking at a miracle in progress. I read the label carefully. I wanted to make sure I did it exactly right. But I had become so involved in the process of looking for this that I couldn't bring myself to put it on. What if it didn't work? What would I do then? I fell asleep that night without ever putting any of it on my body. After 3 weeks of anticipation, and I got up the next morning and looked at my freckles in the mirror and said, "Elizabeth, this is silly. You have to do it now." And so I slathered it all over my body. There wasn't as much of it as I had thought there would be. And I could see that I was going to have a part-time job to supply my freckle remover habit. But as I did nearly every day in the summertime, I took my hoe and went with my brother and my cousins to the head of the holler to hoe tobacco. Now, the thing about hoeing tobacco all day is you don't do it in the shade. The thing about freckle remover is if you wear it in the sun, do you know what you get? More and significantly darker freckles. I ended the day looking as though I had leopard blood in my veins. I came into the house, and the people in my family, knowing nothing about the freckle remover cream, began to say things like, "I've never seen you with that many freckles before." I looked at myself in the mirror and dissolved in tears. My mother called me to the dinner table, and I ignored her. When she came to the bathroom door and demanded that I come out and eat, I ran by her crying. I ran out to the well house and threw myself down, and I was sobbing when my grandfather came out to see what was wrong with me. I explained to him about sending for the freckle remover. He was a good man. He did not laugh. He did suggest that there was some equal validity to burying a dead black cat in the full of the moon to accomplish the same thing. Feeling that my problem was not being sufficiently valued at this point, I turned on him. Because when I explained to him, at his request, why I didn't want to have freckles, he looked at me in stunned surprise as I began to compare my appearance with Jeanette Elizabeth's. And he shook his head and he said, "But child, there are all kinds of flowers, and they are all beautiful." And I said, "I've never seen a flower with freckles." And I ran into my room and slammed the door. My mother came and knocked, and I told her to go away. And she began to respond with the things that parents say at those kinds of times. But my grandfather said, "Nancy, leave the child alone." And even though she was a grown-up, he was her father. So she left me alone. I don't know where he found it. They are not at all common in the mountains where I was at that time. But I know my grandfather put it there, for I was told that by my mother later. For when I opened my eyes the next morning, still slightly swollen and sticky from having cried myself to sleep, laying on the pillow on the bed next to my head, was a tiger lily.
Great story, huh? A freckled flower, in case you didn't get it. All right. Here's Eric.
More than anything else, my understanding of how to treat pain was influenced by Eric's, and I think he knew more about that than other people whom
that's
I
Joe
have
Barb.
Read or worked with, and that's what I really learned a lot from him about. I think fundamentally what I learned was that pain is mutable. All pain is mutable, not just some pain and not just some people, but period. And that was impressive to me. And in some ways that sounds very simple, but I think that that's not something most people know.
So here's
Erickson liked to emphasize that his difficulties had a positive effect on his work.
Treating a young woman
an example is pain.
Partially paralyzed and in
he
pain.
He suffered severe pain all his life based on his polio. Some of the cramps he had were so severe that the muscles pulled away from the ligaments. He used auto-hypnosis to control that pain when he could. In the process of understanding and working with his own pain, Erickson understood pain better than any other therapist because he had been down that road himself.
She was in a car in Santa Barbara with a young man, and he drove over 150-foot embankment. And Nicole was thrown out of the car.
She was in a car accident. That's her mother.
Her back was broken. She does have a lot of pain at night, and even in her sleep, she cries out. She probably doesn't remember in the morning.
It only makes your pain worse.
When I'm depressed.
How often is that?
How often? I don't know.
What are you depressed about?
Living situation and being in the wheelchair.
How old are you?
19.
And what would you like to have me do for you?
What? I'd like you to help me walk again.
If I can't help you walk again, then what?
Help my pain.
And you keep sleeping deeper and deeper until you know what it is you want to forget. There's something else you need to do. To know why you never completed that work of the fancy work of a mouse. You're not using the muscle you have. You got a very smooth face. You have too short a smile, not a wide enough smile. You don't use your muscles around your eyes enough. And you can have a dimple if you wish. Well, that's a dimple that's awfully under exercise.
Yeah, like I never really did anything for myself then. I never did anything that made me happy. Mm-hmm. I wasn't even around people I liked. Mm-hmm. You know? I mean, now I have, you know, friends that I really, just really like to be around.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm doing things that I like to do, and I'm enjoying them. And then I just didn't have anything going for myself at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing.
Mm-hmm. I know you're suffering constantly.
savvy, pulsating pain. I can see it with my eyes. And tell me, madam, if you saw a lean, hungry tiger next to him, only walking into the room, and eyeing you hungrily and licking his chops, how much pain would you feel? I wouldn't feel any under those circumstances. Why couldn't I? I don't feel any pain now. May I take the tiger back to the hospital with me?
So, you can tell that's a whole tape about how Erickson dealt with pain. And you can tell what he kept doing is shifting the viewing. You know, and a little shifting the doing, but, you know, you don't use your muscles enough. You're not exercising your muscles enough. You don't, you know, your smile isn't wide enough. You don't use that dimple. And she starts smiling, and in 3 years she's walking and pain-free. It's pretty good. So changing the viewing, that's what we're talking about here, right? I don't think we're going to have time to show this, sorry. But that's a changing perception. The NLP people did change perception a bit. I just want to make sure we get through the rest of this. So I think you've gotten the point about changing viewing. Changing perceptions, changing the focus of attention, changing meanings and interpretations. Changing the context, what is that? Change everything around the problem situation. Change the locations, change the time or the timing, change the associations with it, change the biochemistry, change the neurology, change the physiology, change the systems. Anything that's not directly involved in the action and viewing of the problem. What else is the rest of it? So sometimes you'll change the family context. Sometimes you'll change the system. Sometimes you'll change the neurology. Sometimes you'll change the physiology. Sometimes you'll change the kind of associations people have to it, locations. Anything you can change that doesn't directly have to do with the problem but surrounds it. That's what we're talking about, changing the context, right?
More examples. Some brilliant recent work, totally amazing study that was done recently. Here's what's done. Researchers got the volunteers to come in, and in the first scenario, they asked the person to tell them something about what their high school was like or some such thing as part of this psych study. And afterward, they say, well, we can't pay you for doing this, but just as a token, do you want this new fountain pen or do you want this package of hand wipes? And those are the two gewgaws and, you know, 50-50. Now instead, the subjects come in and they're asked to tell about a time where they had a grave moral failure, a time where they did something awful. Afterward, you say, well, we can't pay you, but here's a choice. You can have a pen or the hand. And a way disproportionate percentage ask for the hand wipes. They're feeling dirty afterward. They want to cleanse themselves. And in a remarkable elaboration, what they now did in this study was everybody had to come in and tell about their sins, and then afterward, half the people were given an opportunity to go to the bathroom and wash up, half were not. They come back to the room, and as things were staged, some assistant comes into the room holding a whole stack of papers and trips and drops all of them. If you've just washed your hands after talking about your sins, you are less likely to get up and help this person pick this stuff up. You have washed away your sins. You have washed away this incentive to help someone else. All this suggesting something about soap here has something to do with how we think about moral failures and what sort of imperatives come out of that. Absolutely wild. Another example. Here in this study, people were coming up to some psych department in their university, and it was going to be some puzzle solving, who knows what, and unknown to them, of course, the actual experiment took place in the elevator. Get in the elevator, and there's somebody waiting there, ready to get in, also is holding a whole stack of papers and barely and holding on to a drink, and the person says, can you do me a favor, can you just hold on to this, because I got to pull these together. In half the cases, the person, the subject, was asked to hold a cup of warm, hot coffee. In half the cases, it was a cup of iced coffee, a hot cup or a cold cup. Then they go in and they do this very brief test, and then afterward they're asked to assess what was the tester like, how did you feel about them, hold the warm cup in your hand, and you were more likely to assess this person as having had a warm personality. We confuse the part of the brain that's telling us something about temperature here is somehow confusing. No, that's a metaphor, a warm personality. This person is a total ice queen, whatever, and will freeze all of Narnia over, and just because you were holding the cup of ice. And our brain has a lot of trouble telling those apart. Another example. Here, subjects were being put through a study, and they were sitting in a chair like the comfy sofa on the left or this stark one on the right there, and they're reading somebody's job resume and or some scenario, and they're asked to make assessments afterward. Sit in the chair on the right, and you are more likely to judge the people you read about as being more serious, having more gravity about them, being more focused. You're sitting there, and where you're sitting is changing your perception. And what we have, they didn't ask in the study there, but I think what we can almost certainly agree is that people who sat chairs on the right are more likely to perceive people as being hard-assed. And again, metaphors being mixed. Here's one of the most fascinating ones. This was a recent study where people read a stretch of a page about American history. And it was either written in a conventional way or a way that very much personified the United States as an organism. It was in America's infancy that it first began to do what? It was after the Civil War that America had a growth spurt, whatever. So either neutral or in a personified way. And in the study, before you read this, you either read something neutral or you read something about the health risks of bacteria. And what they showed was, if you were thinking about the United States as being personified and you've just read about scary bacteria in questionnaires afterward, you are more hostile to immigration. You are more likely to view immigrants as dangerous pathogens coming in. This is an absolutely wild way in which this metaphor stuff, as abstract as you can get, is inadvertently being processed by the brain in the most concrete little ways, and out comes all sorts of ways in which we are subtly being shaped by this phenomenon.
All right, so that's Robert Sapolsky. I forgot to introduce you. He gave a keynote address at the this brief therapy conference a few years ago. I'm not going to play this one again. We don't have time, but... what I'm suggesting, and this is something I learned from Erickson, is that, you know, he would change the associations that people had by speaking about things in different ways. And, you know, I don't know if you know the famous Artistry of Milton Erickson tape, but he's working with a woman named Mondi, and she is getting a hand levitation, and she smiles in what looks to me like a self-conscious way, like she's a little embarrassed. And he says, "And now you know, and it's delightful to know, isn't it?" All he says is delightful to know because her smile is linked to delight now. And she starts to smile more and more, and he says, "I hope you're enjoying it as much as I imagine you're enjoying it, and I think you're enjoying it more than I can imagine." He starts to link enjoyment with the hand levitation. She looks self-conscious to me, but he took it in another direction, and she starts to more and more enjoy it and talks about later how enjoyable it was. You link certain things. I have another case of Erickson's. He has this woman come in with phobias, three phobias, and he does hypnosis with her, and as she's sitting in the chair, he says, "And now as you're sitting in that chair, your phobias can start to drain out of your body into this chair." And she comes out of trance, she jumps out of the chair, and she won't sit back down in it because those are the phobias. Erickson calls his wife, Betty, in and says, "Betty, will you sit in this chair?" And the woman wouldn't let her sit down. She said, "No, you can't sit there. You'll get my phobias." That is weird. But this is what human beings do. They create contexts and associations for things. So you can change the physical location. Erickson would sometimes be working with someone and it wouldn't be working. He'd say, "You find yourself really resistant sitting in that chair." And they'd say, "Yes." And he'd say, "So what I'd like you to do is move to this chair and we'll do the hypnosis." Just change the location. I've had people go, you know, out to their car to argue, couples to go out to their car to argue. It just changes the context. That's it. Weird stuff. Milieu therapy, I mentioned before, get a bigger perspective, time or spirituality. You know, I have a friend who wrote a whole book called Out of the Box for Life,
And his whole method is helping people get a change in perspective on their problems. He wrote this whole book. He told me about it. He said, people are shifting in like 5 minutes. I'm getting people to a totally different place. I said, you got to write a book about that. And so he went and wrote a book. HarperCollins published it. Change physiology or neurology. I think a lot of these EMDR things and tapping therapies change people's neurology. I have a friend who's a neurologist, and when this stuff first came out, I said, you know, they're having people move their eyes and they're tapping on their cheeks and stuff. He said, if you saw what was going on in the brain, if you move your eyes, there's a lot of new stuff happening in the brain. If you saw it on a functional MRI, a lot of stuff is happening. And usually the people are grooved and they're going in a certain pattern neurologically. You get them to move their eyes, tap, hum, count numbers. Erickson used to, when people had aphasia and they couldn't speak, he would have them sing or do patty cake, patty cake. And then what he'd do is say, patty cake, patty cake, and he'd have their caretaker move their hands because they were often partially paralyzed from the stroke, and they couldn't say any words. They hadn't been able to speak since the stroke. And he would use a rhythmic thing, and pretty soon they go, patty cake, baker's man. And they could do the rhythmic speaking because it comes from a different part of the brain, I guess. And then he'd have the person who was doing rehab with him stop, put it in the oven for a baby, and yeah, and they'd go, me, 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 and they would say their first words because he couldn't stand not to finish the thing because they had a whole context where that needed to be completed, you know, in a certain way. And he'd use the rhythm, a whole different context of speaking. He once had a guy who stuttered sing everything he had to say at first and then move over to speaking. Change the context, right? Change something in the environment. We already saw the effect of that. Robert Sapolsky talked about that. Have him move to a different chair. I've had people go home when they're stuck on a problem and rearrange the furniture in their house. And they said, it was the weirdest thing. I had all sorts of new ideas when I rearranged the furniture. It's like I got unstuck. Weird. Something new in your environment, maybe something new in your brain. A new way to think. Change associations, I've already talked about that, right? All right. I one time had a woman who came to see me, and it was weird, it's a long story, let's see if I can make it short. She came to see me and said, my husband doesn't want me to be here. He thinks there's no problem with our daughter, but I think she's the devil. I think she's a devil child. I think she's Satan's son, Satan's daughter, basically, Satan's spawn. Okay, so tell me about this. She said, I have three kids. First one's great, third one's great. This one, from the moment she was in my womb, I felt she was different. That gives you a hint, right? Unless she really is Satan's spawn, probably there's something else going on. But she says, she defies me at every turn except when my husband's there. Then she's the little, you know, Eddie Haskell angel kid. Just perfectly behaved. As soon as my husband looks away, she'll give me a hateful look. If we're sitting in the living room and I'm sitting here and my husband's sitting here and he can't see into the kitchen and my daughter's there, she'll look at me with hate. As soon as he leaves, she starts to defy me and, you know, won't do anything I ask her to do, will yell at me and really, you know, she's just evil, basically. I tell my husband, he says, I don't see it. She said, of course you don't see it, because only when you're not, you know, she gets really upset. She says, I need to bring her to therapy. There's something wrong with her. He said, there is nothing wrong with her. You're being paranoid. We're not taking her to therapy. You're not going to do that to her. She's a normal kid like the other kids. All our kids are fine. So they have these big arguments about it. Finally, she says, I need some help. I can't take this anymore. She's 12 years old. I'm going crazy. So I said, okay, well, you know, if your husband doesn't want you to bring her in, I need something to go on. So what I want you to do is go home and get a tape recorder and record what she does so I can give you some consultation about what to do with it. She came right before Christmas, and she wasn't going to be able to come in for another month based on the vagaries of her schedule and my schedule. She comes back in a month, and I said, what happened? She said, well, I don't really have a tape for you. And I said, what, you didn't do it? And she said, well,
First of all, it was Christmas, and we have an old tape recorder, and the batteries were gone. We didn't have any batteries, and so it took me a couple weeks to get it together, to get the tape recorder together. And then when I got it together, I first turned it on in the morning when her father was gone, and she was defying me, and I got out the tape recorder, and I didn't feel right doing it without telling her and the other kids. So I said, I've gone to see a therapist. He's asked me to record you so we can figure out what's wrong with you. And the kid said, I am not talking when that tape recorder is on. So she turned it on. The kid didn't say a word. She said, I couldn't get anything for you. Every time I turned it on, she'd stop talking. I said, well, how have things been going? She said, great. She's not defying me. You know, everything's going great. I said, well, I need the tape or I can't help you. Go home. Come back in another month. We'll give you a whole month to get really good stuff on the tape. She comes back and she goes, she won't talk when the tape recorder's on. And she said, you know, I have a really weird thing I have to say to you. When the tape recorder's on, I talk a little more nicely because I know you're going to be listening to it, and I don't want you to be judging me harshly. So I treat her a little nicer, and she seems to be responding to that. We're getting along really well. She goes, you know, actually, the batteries wore out after a while, and I didn't get out to get any new ones. So sometimes I just push the button. It's not really recording, just to get her to, you know, be good. And it totally solved the problem. That was it. She never had another problem with her. She started not to see her, and then later she told me that she had an affair when she got pregnant with this girl, and she wasn't sure whether it was her husband's child or the other person's child. She never told her husband, but maybe that's why she thought this child was different from the rest. So, whatever. I told the story today. It's going to take too long. I can't tell it. Bandler was once, Richard Bandler, an NLP guy, was once doing consultation in the Midwest. And the therapist comes in, you know, Midwest, and says, you know, I have a client that's delusional, is talking to angels. Bandler says, I have a simple solution. Tell her to move to Santa Cruz. Or Santa Fe, where I live. You'd be fine there. You live in a Midwest city, and that is really out there. You live in Santa Cruz, you might earn a living at that, right? You know, definitely. Or they at least have a great deal of tolerance for it. And, you know, in Santa Fe, you could start a center if you talk to angels. That is not a problem, you know, in my place. All right. So years ago, John Weakland, who was one of my friends and a student of Erickson's, said I went to see Stanford with my stepdaughter who was thinking of going to university there. And I said, oh, John Weakland lives nearby. And she was thinking of becoming a therapist. I said, he's a good friend of mine. Let's go visit him, and he'll tell you about what it's like to be a therapist. So he sits there, and John's about 70 at this point. He's smoking his pipe, holding forth. He loves to talk, and, you know, we're good buddies. So he's talking to Angie, my stepdaughter, and he says, well, you know, therapy, he said, we've had 100 years of therapy, and he said, we thought we could just make everybody's lives problem-free if we gave them long enough and good enough therapy. But he said, after 100 years of therapy, we realize that's not true. You just can't make people's lives problem-free. He says, why? Because life, as the old saying goes, is just one damn thing after another. And just when you think you got all the answers to the problem, they change the question. And, you know, so life is just one damn thing after another. He said, but for people to come into therapy, life has become the same damn thing over and over. So that just went into my mind. And a couple of years later, I was just thinking about what he said. That when he said that, I thought, that was a really great thing to say. And then I just had this flash of insight. I thought, okay, so my job as a therapist is to get people from the same damn thing over and over again back to one damn thing after another and get out of their lives. All I'm trying to do is get them unstuck. It's getting the jar lid unstuck. They can do what they want with their lives after that. It's not like they won't ever have any problems. I just want to get them unstuck. So I found this on Facebook. You know, here's your choice. It's the same old shit or some crazy new shit, is what they say, essentially. That's about it. You know, life is going to be full of stuff, but it really gets wearing when it's the same old shit that goes on again and again and again and again. So this method that I've been talking to you about, this brief therapy method of change the doing, change the viewing, change the contact, is a way to get people unstuck. It may not solve every problem. It may just be an adjunct to the therapy that you're already doing, but it's a brief therapy method. Let me show you one more example of the master of brief change.
Gosh, I hope he doesn't jump off.
Please, please, don't do this terrible thing. You're young. You have everything to live for. You'll be only hurting those who love you. And think of the loss to science.
Hans, how did he get out there?
Isn't it terrible, Peter? First I find him with a surgical knife, and now this. I've tried everything.
Bribery?
Bribery, threats, tears.
And why did you send for me?
You're a psychologist. You psychologist.
On him?
It might work. Please.
All right, I'll give it a try.
Be very gentle with him. For days now, he has been sulking.
He does brief therapy with a suicidal client. Here.
Good morning. Bad as all that?
Bedtime for Bonzo.
Long way down, isn't it, Bonzo?
No, no, no.
Go ahead, Bonzo. I want you to jump. Jump, Bonzo. Jump.
Peter, what are you doing?
I'm trying inverted psychological domination. He should refuse to jump. Go ahead, Bonzo. I want you to jump. Jump, Bonzo. Jump.
Try something else. $2,000 he costs the college.
Maybe he'll respond to the Gestalt theory.
Change the view. Change the focus of attention.
Bonzo. Pretty, Bonzo? Nice. Here, Bonzo. Yeah. Things look better now, Bonzo? Happy, Bonzo?
It's working. It's working.
Come on. I won't let you fall. Let's go home. Come on. Watch it, Bonzo. Steady. Hey, Bonzo! Take it easy. Shh. Come on, Bonzo. I'll get you home. Now, hang on, Bonzo. Don't look down, Bonzo. Watch it, Bonzo. Steady. Hey, Bonzo!
Peter, don't drop Bonzo.
Come on up, Bonzo. Don't worry. Don't be scared, Bonzo. Take it easy. That's it. Steady, Bonzo. Bonzo!
Bonzo, don't drop Peter.
Take it easy, Bonzo.
Careful. You'll make it. No, babe.
Come on. Next time, call a zoo.
I don't know whether to thank you for saving Bonzo or to thank Bonzo for saving you.
A Gestalt for saving both of us.
All right. Little did you know that our former president was a great psychologist who knew how to change the viewing, right? All right. So thank you for being here. Remember that the slides will be on my website, free stuff, BillHannon.com, free stuff, then slides. Thank you for listening. I hope I've changed the view and changed something you do and changed your context. Thank you.